Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about now that Helda Solis is stepping down as Secretary of Labor, who's going to be a replacement? And what does it mean for workers across the nation? Also, for all the shiny distractions brought to us by the congressional puppeteers and all of the chest thumping about, oh, we're going to rebuild the manufacturing base in this country that we've given away. Well, the trade numbers are in, and, well, again, no surprise, we're screwed. Also, well, I guess it's official, flu epidemic upon us. What's that going to mean? What advice did the CDC give? Well, they said stay home, get some rest, take care of yourself. But given the current employment climate, can we? The numbers are out there that, you know what, people who, large number of folks who do stay home are threatened to be fired, or they are fired because we don't have paid sick days. We don't have a family leave act that protects workers. It's just not there. Also going to talk about guns, guns, guns. Some surprising defections, however. The NRA, well, can't be happy about the fact that you've got some congressional Republicans saying, we better think about this. And also a lot of the faith community saying, well, we are pro-life. Interesting. And also, it's the Bread and Roses Day, the 101st anniversary of the Bread and Roses strike up in Massachusetts. Going to talk about what the strike itself and what it's meant to workers. The sad reality is in this country, I shouldn't say we've forgotten labor's history. It's been deliberately withheld from us. The wealth class has deliberately made sure that it doesn't get into our textbooks. It doesn't get into the classrooms. Because they don't want us to see, as the kids in Wisconsin, when the governor said, I'll call out the National Guard, and I'm going to bring in the National Guard. And they had, because in Wisconsin it's mandatory every eighth grader, has at least a semester of labor education. So you know your history. And they said, well, wait a second, I remember back in eighth grade, they taught us about, you know, the Ludlow Massacre or the Latimer Massacre or any number of these where the governor called out the militia or the sheriffs called out deputies and they shot people dead. That's our history. A very, very bloody, bloody history. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind. Interesting evening tonight. The public polling policy people, I love the things that they decide they want to look at. They looked at Pennsylvania Republican voters. So they went and they did a survey of Pennsylvania Republican voters. Now, this was before this afternoon's announcement, which I will get to. They asked the question, do you approve or disapprove of Governor Tom Corbett? And Republicans, 54% of them approve, 31 disapprove, 15 not quite sure. Those are the ones who probably don't really care about anything. Do you support or oppose Corbett's lawsuit against the NCAA over the Jerry Sandusky sanctions there? 67% said yes and very much in support of, 19 opposed, again, 14% not sure. And then they were asked, do you approve of how he handled the Penn State situation? 42% of Republicans approved, which then, you know, you kind of go, well, hold on a second. Walk me back. And I'm not saying Republican voters aren't the brightest, but this has got to call into some questions. 67% support the lawsuit. 19% are opposed to it, yet 42% think he did a good job. Interesting, because 33% disapprove of the way he handled the Penn State thing, and 25%, well, they're not sure. I don't know. They asked the question, would you like to see somebody else run for governor? And 45% said they want Corbett, 37% said somebody else, 17%. They don't know. They asked the question, if you were going to vote for someone today, would you vote for Corbett or the guy who ran against him, who I've forgotten who Bruce Castor was, had to actually go look it up, to be honest. And, you know, got to give them credit. Nobody else heard of Bruce Castor either. Only 11% said they'd vote for him. 38% not sure. Now, the question I have, given the numbers they are in, and 54% today, at that moment of this survey, they approved of what Corbett has been doing. I now ask that 54%, Now that you know our governor has hocked off our lottery, did I mention the governor announced today that they're going to go forward with privatizing the lottery, the management of the lottery? Yeah, you know, hey, profits go somewhere. The governor said that, well, you know, because he immediately went to Twitter. You know, he loves Twitter. Twitter Tom loves Twitter. He just doesn't love the people on it, if you remember the whole subpoena thing. But he went right to Twitter, said a notice of award is not a binding contract. Wants us to believe that there's going to be full transparency on Monday's hearing, because there's going to be a hearing about this. And, you know, it's kind of like I've already agreed that, yeah, we're going to do it. We just haven't signed the, you know, we just haven't dotted the I's and crossed the T's, but it's done. Well, you can have your little hearing on Monday, and then on Tuesday, we'll do whatever we got to do. And I love that appearance that, well, we're going to let you have your little meeting. You got to love that. Instead of going through the process and saying, should we bother even doing this? We're just doing it. And do you know why? And this is something I talked about almost the day he took office. This governor, and you can go back and find the tapes, he came up with a privatization board. He got this board together, and their charge was not to examine whether we should or should not privatize things. It's what to privatize. What are we hocking off? What is it that we the people own, that you and me and all the other taxpayers in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, what do we own that's of value that the private sector wants? What can we sell them? And you had, and we went through the list at the time of all the people who were on this board, and you know, you had the Tinky Tank people and all these right-wing cranks who, that's their ideology. Their blind faith ideology is nothing should be in the hands of we the people. Everything should be in the hands of the wealth class. And they'll decide what we can have down at the bottom. And for how much. So what we're seeing is we're seeing the blind faith, because the privatization people, they have decided that the management of the lottery would be better in the hands of the profiteers. Now understand, our lottery right now, the numbers that I've seen, our lottery right now has an operating cost of 2%. The company that's taking it over, in a place where they do this kind of work, 4%. That money's going to go somewhere. Unless they've learned their lessons in the other place. Unless they learned, or they're going to consolidate all those jobs overseas, and those folks will take care of it. Maybe it'll bring their total cost. Who knows? But I'm telling you right now, seniors, you're getting the screw job. It's going to happen, because they're going to throw up their hands and go, well, you know, we can't increase senior programs. We only have this much money secured. And it's not even secured, because as I'm reading through more of the information, well, it's not really secured. They're going to put up some money, but you could only take so much out per year. So they're going to put up $200 million, they claim. So if next year there's a $200 million shortfall, we don't get $200 million. Because you can't get more than 5% of the total loss from the fund. And I look at this and I go, you know, it's a nice scam. I mean, you've really figured. And look, they're not in business to lose money. The business that's taking this over, and look, you can't blame them. If I were them, I'd be fighting for the best deal that I could get. I'd be fighting to screw the taxpayers of this Commonwealth as hard and as long as I possibly could. Because hooray for me, and basically the heck with you. And that's what I see this deal as. Like all of the privatization schemes. Because no for-profit, no person who has money, no business is going to get into something because, oh, I feel that I'm just doing something for the public good. Out of the goodness of my heart, I'm gonna provide this service. Oh, they're in it because they can make money, and lots of it. They're going to make their investment back plus some. If you remember when I talked to Donna Cooper several months back, she said, you know, when they were talking about leasing the turnpike, the people who wanted to lease it, they wanted a guarantee, an absolute guarantee that they were going to make at least as much money as they would have made anywhere else. Opportunity cost. We learned about that in 100 Level Economics. They wanted that guarantee. So the taxpayers would have guaranteed the for-profit corporation profits. And I see this as the same thing. Look, this company's not going to get involved in taking over our lottery if they know they can't make a ton of money. And the new games are going to come out, the Keno and the online gambling, I'm sure will come out, and I'm sure they will be wildly profitable, and guess who will not get a penny of the proceeds? That's right, Granny, you're out in the cold. Oh, I know, I've heard. Rick, you're trying to scare old people. No, not necessarily. I think the numbers speak for themselves, especially at the rates that they're talking about things going up. The inflationary rate of the profits, nowhere near. And also, the agreement that they're going to roll back the law from 30% of what the lottery brings in back to 27%. So right there's a 3% profit. Why don't we just do that and give that money to seniors too? No, Rick, we can't, because private is always better. And you also, if you didn't know, the other day, I guess it was, Wednesday? The privateers came out and announced that they were going to privatize with the P3 partnership, the public-private partnership. You know, gotta love that. They're going to privatize the PennDOT's 511 system, the 511 PA, Pennsylvania Turnpike Roadway Information Program. You know, all of those things that they do now. Going to be in the hands of privateers. So I ask you, are you going to be comfortable with all of the cameras and all the information stuff that our government does in the hands of profiteers? Of course you will, because profit does it better, right? Oh, well, here we go. Going to talk about that as well tonight. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel reacted to the shooting at Taft High School Thursday by saying the California teachers have serious concerns about the increased number of school shootings in America. Vogel said the teacher's thoughts and best wishes for a speedy recovery go out to the student injured in that shooting. The California Teachers Association also commends the teacher and campus supervisor for their quick responses as they put themselves in harm's way to protect students. The CTA says this latest shooting reiterates the need for communities to come together to ensure we have safe learning environments for all students. Some UAW workers unhappy with deteriorating working conditions at the Detroit 3 will be demonstrating across from the Detroit Auto Show over the weekend and Monday. Auto worker Caravan will be doing the protest. They say that the global restructuring of the Detroit 3 automakers has been on the backs of working people to maximize profits. When two of the Detroit 3 were rescued by the federal government, the restructuring meant that auto workers lost their annual cost of living adjustments, lost some break and holiday time, suffered a drop in overtime pay, while also allowing the companies to pay new hires lower wages. The auto worker Caravan workers say the American companies are adopting a Mexican maquiladora model for U.S. auto workers. The workers say that means using more temporary workers paid as little as $9 an hour, increasing the pace of assembly work, imposing alternative work schedules and flexible operating patterns that force workers into 10-hour-plus shifts, and being harassed by management when injured on the job. The workers are calling for a further restructuring of the U.S. auto industry to improve the deteriorating working conditions for auto workers while building much-needed clean, green vehicles and mass transit to meet national needs while creating good jobs. Organized labor leaders are praising the work of Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, who is resigning soon. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that Secretary Solis, quote, brought urgently needed change to the Department of Labor, putting the U.S. government firmly on the side of working families, end quote. He said Solis never lost sight of her working class roots and always put the values of working families at the center of everything she did. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa said Secretary Solis has been a strong advocate for working families throughout her public career, and as the daughter of a Teamsters shop steward, she learned early in life the value of a strong labor movement. Hoffa says she will be missed. This newscast, made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
We're seeing, now that you're seeing Geithner leaving as Treasury Secretary, what you're seeing is the Wall Street shuffle. I got to be honest, when Geithner said he was leaving for a brief moment, it was just a glimpse of a moment. I was hoping there might possibly be a change, you know, maybe a change in direction, some fresh ideas, or at least somebody who wasn't a Wall Street shill. And, you know, here's the thing that bothers me. We've got a mainstream media that's caught up, enamored, if you will, with the Lou loop. I don't want to see our economy screwed up by someone my grandmother would have called a real Lulu. I just don't. But here to talk about the Lou appointment, our nomination at this point, is William Black. He's an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was also a senior regulator during the SNL debacle years ago. William, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So I guess the first question right off the bat, you look at Geithner, you look at Lou, is there any difference?
No. The whole point of the Lou appointment is to not only create continuity, but to signal to Wall Street continuity.
That does not make me feel good.
Well, it should make you feel worse than not good.
This is not the change that I was hoping for. You know, the same bad policies that got us into the crisis that we're in, I don't want to see continue.
Yeah, so this is, both of these people are part of the architects that brought us the crisis. Geithner was, of course, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In that capacity, he was supposed to regulate the largest bank holding companies in America. And he was a abject failure for my sins, I've had to read hundreds and hundreds of pages of the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee and read what Geithner said there and read his speeches. And he was utterly clueless about the coming crisis. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has been very heavily criticized for its regulatory failures under his control.
So then maybe my criticism of Alan Greenspan is misplaced, because Greenspan said of the derivatives that, well, we don't have regulators who are smart enough to regulate them, so they should be unregulated.
Well, if you wanted to pick a single person most responsible for the crisis, I think we could agree it was Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan was a key ally of Jacob Lew in one of his first areas of creating the disaster. And that was under President Clinton when he was the budget director, OMB director, and was one of the architects of the two key statutory acts of deregulation under Clinton. One, they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which is the dream of the largest banks. Two, they squashed Brooksley-Bourne. And I don't know whether your listeners are familiar with Brooksley-Bourne, but she's one of the people that really deserves praise for trying to prevent this crisis. She was chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. And by the way, in her Greenspan story, in her very first meeting with him, invites her over, you know, has lunch in the executive dining room, and says, it's nice to meet you, but of course we're going to disagree about a lot of things, which she thought was a rather odd opening line. And he went on to explain, you probably think that fraud is a reason for regulation.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So, going forward, Brooks Liborn was one of those people that looked ahead. And she said, there are these exotic financial derivatives, credit default swaps, and they're very dangerous, and they're totally unregulated. So we need to consider regulating them. And Wall Street went crazy. Some of your listeners may have read the book 13 Bankers. Well, that's where the title of that book comes from. Rubin, I think it was, calls Brooks Liborn up and says, I have 13 bankers in my office, and they say that the financial system is going to collapse because of what you're doing, which is, of course, ludicrous. But the Rubinites within the Clinton administration, which very much included his protégés, Geithner and Liu, became very big at squashing Brooks Liborn's effort to regulate credit default swaps. And credit default swaps, to do a little foreshadowing, blew up AIG, but far larger than that, they were critical to the collateralized debt obligations that caused greater losses than any single category. So really bad stuff. Brooks Liborn tries to protect us, and they get together, all these people, along with Republicans, Phil Graham in particular in the Senate, and Alan Greenspan, and they get this law passed under Clinton in 2000, the Commodities Future Modernization Act, and it doesn't say, you know, this particular regulation, Ms. Bourne, that you're thinking of going and adopting, you cannot adopt it. Instead, it says, we hereby remove all regulatory jurisdiction at the federal level, the state level, and the local level. Nobody can be sheriff. These things are totally unregulated, and to ensure that, we'll even preempt, that means, in this context, render unenforceable the state laws against gambling and even state laws against bucket shops. So this is a fraudulent trading operation. So you have this, and I'm not making this up, this is explicit exceptions in the text of this law. That's how extreme it was. And it produced a disaster. So that's what Liu did on the statutory side. On the regulatory side, he was a big believer in the effort to stop regulations. Now, people probably don't remember this, but Al Gore, in his first incarnation, was the leader under President Clinton of the effort to, quote-unquote, reinvent government. And reinventing government was this thing that was exceptionally hostile to labor, and organized labor in government in particular. But it was also very pro business community,
sure,
and especially banking. So we were not supposed to regulate. At most, we were supposed to have unenforceable guidelines. And so they got rid of key regulations that prevented these fraudulent loans and replaced them with unenforceable guidelines. And you weren't supposed to take supervisory actions or harsh enforcement actions because that indicated that you were a failure as a regulator. And you were supposed to refer to the industry, and I witnessed this personally, as your client. So as a banking examiner or regulator, I was supposed to call the bank my client, and I was instructed by Washington to think of the bank as my client.
Well, I mean, it goes to that whole business-friendly mentality that we've been shoved down our throat for years. That, and the incestuous relationship of regulators in the industry, and that swinging door back and forth to where, you know, you don't want to tick off big business, you don't want to tick off your client, because that's where you're going to go to work in a couple years.
And Liu exemplifies that, because after he produces these disasters, and in his role as the OMB, helps starve the Securities and Exchange Commission for funds. Remember, this is happening in 1999, 2000, and it sets up the whole wave of scandals that break in 2001 with the Enron failure. And he helps cut places like the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, one of the key regulators of banks. So the FDIC lost more than three-quarters of its personnel through forced cuts and buyouts. If you, again, want to know why there's a disaster, it's the lose of the world. But then your point is quite correct. Then they have to cash in. And where are they going to cash in? Well, Rubin by that time has left. Rubin had been head of Goldman Sachs. He joined Citibank at a really senior position, and he brings along proteges eventually, like Jack Lew. So Jack Lew has two jobs at Citicorp. One is in charge of the, what they call their private wealth management. That means that a mere millionaire is sort of an embarrassment for the bank to be, you know, if you see them in the corridors, they only want to deal with a real plutocrat,
billionaire. Yeah, the Forbes people.
Yes, exactly. So that was his job. Now, remember, Lew is a lawyer. He has no expertise in finance. So what is he supposed to do for these guys? The whole idea is political connections, of course. And then his second job, even worse, is in charge of this trading arm, or one of the people in charge, that trades exotic derivatives where the bank owns them. And in other words, this isn't for a client. So think of this in public policy terms. We, the U.S. government, are giving this express subsidy called deposit insurance to the banks, and we're giving Citicorp a vastly larger implicit subsidy of too big to fail that's going to lead to all these bailouts. And what do they do with it? They go to Las Vegas, in essence.
Yeah.
If they win the bet, they keep the money. If they lose the bet, we get to bail them out. And they, of course, knowing nothing about finance, they mostly lost the bet. And Wall Street then did what Wall Street always does if you fail. They gave him a huge bonus, almost $1 million. That's just a bonus. His salary, of course, was on top of that, and his salary was huge.
The whole fail upward thing.
Yeah, so they made Lew wealthy for screwing up, and then having screwed up in the government and screwed up at Citicorp, they brought him back into the Obama government, where he tried to screw up and again do the incredibly anti-labor, anti-employee austerity programs that have thrown the Eurozone back into recession and nations like Spain and Italy and Greece into Great Depression levels of unemployment. So I've got a piece that where I went through what OMB, Office of Management and Budget, was saying under Lew, and it sounds just like the Tea Party. I mean, it's like, who won the elections, guys?
Yeah, I mean, none of the tax issues were solved. I mean, we ended up making the Bush tax cuts permanent for a large number of the folks that we were supposed to be getting the money to help solve our deficit. Yet they got off on this. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, I don't see the difference in party. You know, you look at Clinton, you look at Bush, you look at, you know, Obama. It's all the same players.
These guys don't care about party. They care about Wall Street.
They care about money.
They care about Wall Street because Wall Street will make them wealthy and prestigious, and it will protect them. It doesn't matter whether they win or lose on the business decisions. They will be made wealthy, and then people will do these backgrounders for the mainstream media in which they talk about what a genius Geithner is, what a genius Lew is.
You know, Professor, for years I've been saying we need to be fighting back against this whole neoliberal agenda, all of it, the deregulating of the banks, all the deregulation, all of the free trade nonsense, all of the anti-work, the no rights at work agenda, all of that. Yet, you know, I just don't see that people are putting it all together. Are you seeing that maybe people are getting this, or is this just we're blinded by team sport political politics?
No, I think a number of people have gotten this from the reaction that I get. But, you know, we were put in a terrible position. As bad as Obama is on these issues, and he is terrible on these issues.
He's still better than Romney.
Romney was far worse. And so you do in those circumstances? So what I did is warn people in advance that this crew, Geithner and Lou and Obama and another guy named Bill Daley, who was a former chief of staff and is another Wall Streeter,
yep,
that wants to privatize Social Security. Why? Because that's Wall Street's greatest dream. They get hundreds of billions of dollars in fees managing our retirement accounts in those circumstances, because those private retirement accounts, of course, would be massively greater if we got rid of Social Security. So,
let me ask you, last line of questioning, a couple minutes on this, because, we're seeing all of this talk of austerity. We're seeing the grand bargain or the grand screw job, however you want to put it. Which is going to, and I truly believe that the Democrats will cave and we will see the retirement age moved up and we will see chain CPI and we will see all of the really horrible things, just maybe a little bit less. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, I've written a number of pieces about this. And by the way, our blog site is New Economic Perspective, and we have a very much pro-worker orientation in all of these things. So the first thing that's going on is we call this the grand betrayal as opposed to the grand bargain. And it is designed to make Obama – they talk about this openly to the press, by the way, that they believe this will be his legacy. So this is pride, right? How am I going to be famous? And the way you're going to be famous is I went against my base. And so just as only a conservative Republican like Dick Nixon could go to what was then called Red China, only a Democratic president can begin the betrayal of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps. So that is exactly what they're after. But don't give up. We've actually, weirdly enough, stopped this three times under Obama. In July 2011, when they tried to do it. In November 2011, when they tried to do it through the super committee. And, of course, just a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, when they tried to do this again, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid looked at the proposed cave-in and surrender by Obama and literally took their document and threw it in his fireplace and burned it up in disgust.
Go ahead.
And refused to implement it.
Yeah, I look at this, and, you get into this team sport back and forth politic, and, sometimes you go, who are your friends, who are your enemies? You look at this proposal, and who knows?
Well, again, they have no permanent party. This is the Rubin wing. This is the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. But remember, it is the Wall Street on the Potomac that they are created.
So is there any way of stopping Lou's appointment, any way of him stopping this? Do you see there being enough of a pushback? And is there anybody else that would be any better?
Oh, sure. There are thousands.
That Obama would consider. I guess I should have put that in there as well.
Well, Obama doesn't want to. No, all the people listed are terrible. So Erskine Bowles is one of the other people whose name was floated as a trial balloon. And Erskine Bowles is elite, again, Wall Streeter to the core, who wants to help privatize Social Security and is in love with austerity. So the only way to do this is to have people get sufficiently outraged, not only about this, but the terrible things that have been done on housing, and the totally disgusting ability now of the elite white-collar banksters to commit fraud and become wealthy and blow up the world economy and never be prosecuted. That is what is bringing crony capitalism full scale to the United States and what must be defeated and can only be defeated. Actually, labor is our biggest hope. We certainly work in a local group here in Kansas City called Jobs Now, where we work actively with unions because they're so much better at organizing and actually getting people to do things on time and under budget.
Well, this is why you're seeing the Republicans especially, but the big money going after organized labor and really trying to cripple them and keep them mired in these battles in each state so that they don't have the ability to fight back on this stuff on a national level.
That's quite correct. Tom Frank, in the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, correctly identified years ago that the Democrats, far too many of their leaders, had forgotten labor and taken it for granted. I guarantee you Republicans have not made that mistake. They recognize it as their most effective opponent, and they are out to destroy all forms of organized labor in the United States and abroad.
Well, which is why we need people out in the streets, and I'm happy to see groups, you know, the port truck drivers just organized, got their first contract, are hearing more people going out in the streets. I think that's where we have to win this, Professor.
I agree.
Professor William Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Love to have you back. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you've experienced any of the following symptoms, crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Looking back at 2012, who was the nuttiest political fruitcake of all? Donnie Trump, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich instantly come to mind, but they're pros at the nutball game, so naming them is unfair to some of the amateur talent that burst on the scene at year's end. For example, Wayne the Insane LaPierre. This honcho of the NRA came completely unwrapped during a December press conference. In a tremulous voice, gun industry lobbyist delivered a rambling 25-minute tirade. He assailed anyone who suggests that the sickening assault weapon slaughter of 6-year-old school kids in Connecticut should prompt us to ban those senseless weapons of mass killing. Rather, ranted LaPierre, the answer is more guns, turning American schools into armed fortresses. If that's crazy, Wayne concluded, then call me crazy. Yet, even Crazy Wayne wasn't 2012's top nut, for he was nipped at the last moment by a 7-man pod of nuts known as the Iowa Supreme Court. On December 21, this all-male court voted 7-0 to decree that, get ready to be whopper-jawed, a male boss may legally fire a female employee for no reason except that he finds her sexually irresistible. Try to get your mind around that. Even though she was not flirtatious, had no interest in him, and had been a stellar worker, she ruled to be at fault, because the boss man can't control his lust. The learned men of the bench insisted that she was not fired because of her gender, but because of his feelings. So it was not discrimination, but merely an act by the boss to save his marriage. Another victory for family values. This is Jim Hightower saying, never mind that he was saving his marriage from himself, not from her. They say that justice is blind, but in Iowa, it's just plain nutty. For their supreme spasm of sublime nuttiness, we award 7 fruitcakes to the Iowa court.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax cuts?
Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis, just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
Right, but you've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
What your definition of success is, honey. You know, and look, success, balancing budgets off the backs of the least among us, success off of kicking 41,000 low-wage workers off of a meager health care program, kicking 88,000 kids off of health care, kicking all of the, 70,000 people off of the general assistance budget. You know, if that's success, we're in big trouble. If cutting $2 billion from public education, if that's success, we're in big trouble. And I look at what happened today. Everybody got outraged about the pay raise. This is something to be outraged about. 5 o'clock on a Friday, you're going to announce that, oh yeah, we're going to decide that we're going to privatize the management of our lottery. Before we have any hearings, before we have any input, before anything, we've announced it. Which is why I've asked Senator Rob Teplitz of the 15th District to come talk to us about this decision. Rob, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. I'm really happy to be here.
So no hearings, no public input. I've yet to have my input on their stealing control of my lottery. What's going on?
Well, it's really outrageous what happened. We have a hearing scheduled for Monday morning, the Senate Finance Committee, a bipartisan hearing, I would add, for 4 hours. We were going to have a substantive discussion on this proposal and try to get some questions answered. And then at about 4:30 this afternoon, we found out that the governor went ahead and signed the agreement anyway, preventing, you know, any meaningful action on the part of the Senate to wait.
Now, he's saying that he didn't, this is just, if I'm reading his Twitter account right, this is a notice of award, which according to him is not a binding contract. We've just gone and we've made the contract, we've made the agreements, we just have to dot an I or two.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. That's actually not how it works. The way that it works is you sign a contract first, and then you issue a notice of award so that the rest of the world knows that you signed a contract. For them to sign the notice of award first doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but none of this makes sense. And now this is just one more issue that we have to explore in the limited time that we'll have on Monday.
I mean, I look at this, and this is, you know, and I go back to some of the first things I said about this governor when he took office. And as he rolled out his privatization committee, all of these right-wing hacks and these pro-privatization people, not to examine what should be, you know, if we should, you know, privatize thing. It's a matter of what they wanted to hack off, what that belongs to me as a taxpayer and the rest of us as taxpayers, what of ours they're going to basically steal from us to hand over to private interests.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, we have two areas of state government that actually bring revenue in and therefore reduce taxes. One is the state liquor store system. The other is the state lottery. He failed on privatizing the former, so I guess he's going after the latter. But it just doesn't make sense from a fiscal point of view, aside from all of the other arguments that are against both.
You know, I look at this and the way he went about this is what has me furious. We can have an honest debate of whether we should be privatizing the wine and spirit shops or whether we should be privatizing, the lottery system or the 511 program here or any other thing that we have. We should have that discussion. Fine. I'm all right with that. But the way he went about this infuriates me. And I think that he learned from the wine and spirit shop that as the arguments they throw out, the more we talk about them, the more it comes to the light of day, the more we, the people, me, you, taxpayers, realize this whole, all these privatization schemes are screwing us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, running a state government is not like running a grand jury. There needs to be openness and transparency. And the fact is that if it is a good deal, then you shouldn't hide it, and you shouldn't be afraid of having a public discussion on it. But doing it this way, you know, at the 11th hour, to prevent us from having a meaningful hearing, to prevent the new attorney general who takes office on Tuesday from weighing in, is really outrageous. And unfortunately, it's part of a pattern that we're seeing with this governor of not getting appropriate oversight, appropriate public input into very important public policy decisions.
Answer me a couple of questions.
Sure.
Because, you know, we've had a couple of guests come and talk about this. It's my understanding that the lottery system, as managed currently by state employees under the control of we the people, has an operating cost of about 2%, which means, you know, the people who are doing the work, processing everything, all of those costs that go into administering the lottery, about 2%. This company that we, I guess, now have contracted with, Camelot, this company from Great Britain, where they have done this in a similar way other places, they have a 4% cost overhead. Is there anything in that that says, hey, you're going to kick that 2% back somehow so that seniors don't lose that?
Well, that's what I'm concerned about, that, you know, the lottery in Pennsylvania is extremely successful. I mean, it made $3.5 billion, with a B, dollars last year. It supports programs and services that older Pennsylvanians depend on. And that's what we're all concerned about, is that those programs and services are at risk. The other thing that I'm concerned about as the senator representing Dauphin and York counties is that half of the employees of the lottery are in this district. These are our friends and neighbors, and what's going to happen to them? What's going to happen to their jobs? What's the impact going to be, you know, on unemployment, on social services that are needed in this area? And that's where I wanted to come from and where I plan to continue focusing on at this hearing on Monday. But, you know, unfortunately, it seems like it may be too late.
Yeah, and will those jobs be in Pennsylvania even? Will they end up in Delaware or even in Great Britain or who knows where?
Exactly. I mean, it's bad enough that he wants to privatize the lottery. But it's not even an out-of-state country. It's a company. It's a foreign company. And, you know, we're supposed to be focused on jobs. And here we are. We're taking away good jobs from people in this area who run an extremely successful enterprise for the benefit of all of Pennsylvania, and outsourcing those jobs to another country. It makes no sense.
Here's what I want to know, Senator Teplitz. You know, as I look at this, the rationale that the governor is making is that, well, we had a fluctuation that 1 year in profits. In 2009, the profits dipped because of, well, the Great Bush Recession. This is supposed to guarantee our profits. So let's say when the Republicans get their austerity plan pushed through, or we don't get a jobs bill or no transportation bill, and let's say the economy double dips and we end up in another recession, and nobody buys lottery tickets next year. Is Camelot going to come up with $2 billion to ensure that we get that $2 billion? Is that, because that's what, the way it seems to me, he's selling it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of the lottery, the revenues to the state have gone up steadily, you know, over the last 20 years, in which there have been ups and downs in the economy during that time, but the revenues have gone up steadily. It is one of the best well-run parts of state government and one of the best run lotteries in the country. And it just doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, look, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If there are things that could be done better, let's do it, but let's keep all the profits as well so that we can invest in ourselves.
Now, you know, what bothers me, now I spoke with Dave Philbin, executive director of AFSCME, mm-hmm. Council 13, the other day, about the jobs part of this and their counter proposal. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I've got a counter proposal. I don't need to read yours. Leave it the hell alone. It's working just fine. 2% overhead? That's it? It sounds like it's run efficiently, it's run well, and oh, we got $1 billion to kick in the senior program. Sounds like it's working well to me. If we want to expand into Keno or online gambling or whatever else the governor sold away, we can do that ourselves, can't we?
Well, that's a good point. You know, the way that the governor says that you increase revenue when you actually look at the details under this Camelot plan is through Keno and through online ticket sales. You don't need to privatize to do that. But I would even go a step further. Personally, I think both of those are a bad idea. I think those expand gambling far beyond what we should be comfortable with. They're not necessary because We're doing well with the lottery right now, and I just don't think that it's appropriate to essentially bring a casino into every neighborhood through Keno, which occurs in bars. And I don't think we should make buying lottery tickets, you know, so easy that you could just go online and maybe in a desperate moment spend a lot of money. So we don't need to do it through privatization, but we shouldn't do it at all.
I'm with you on that. And the reality is I'm, truth be told, I've never bought a lottery ticket in my life, and I probably never will. And even if you expand Keno or every other method, I'm still not going to do it. But if we're going to allow a private for-profit corporation who's going to suck the profits out of not just the state, but out of the country do it, then we the people should do it then.
Mm-hmm.
That's my position.
No, absolutely. And you mentioned the union plan. I mean, clearly the administration didn't read that plan or take it seriously. I mean, they've had it for less than 48 hours before they went ahead and signed this agreement. And that just shows a disrespect to the very same people who work hard and who've made the lottery as successful as it is. And that's just one more aspect of this that's so troubling.
But are you surprised by that? I mean, honestly, I mean, these are people, these are, this is, and I don't want to just generalize Republicans, but I have to. I mean, most of the Republicans today, they seem to beat up on state employees, teachers, firefighters, you know, and whatever. Quite easily, it flows right from their language.
No, I hear what you're saying, and I agree. I mean, it is part of a pattern. You know, here we have employees who've worked hard to make this extremely successful, and you know, they find out at 4:30 this afternoon as they're going out the door, or maybe after some of them have even left for the weekend, that their jobs are at risk.
Yeah, have a good weekend. You're going to be unemployed on Monday.
Exactly. I mean, it's disrespectful to the employees. It's disrespectful to the legislators who are going to have a bipartisan, you know, hopefully very, very significant hearing on these issues on Monday. And it's disrespectful to the seniors who ultimately depend on these programs.
Are there any limits that you've seen? Because I've asked a couple of people. They all tell me that they don't see any limits on campaign contributions. Because I've got to find something. Other than this is just Republican ideology, that there's really nothing in it for we the people. It's just ideology. I got to find something. So are there any limits on campaign contributions, and could that possibly be part of the motive?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen anything. As soon as this idea came out, I became very concerned. You see concern from Democrats and Republicans. I have not talked to a single person who has said to me this is a good idea. And so I think, you know, that explains the rush to get this through before there's any real oversight. And that is what concerns us so much. But the hearing's going to go ahead on Monday.
Good.
We're going to ask the tough questions. But now there's going to be a whole extra level of questioning about what happened today.
Well, let me ask you this, Senator Tuplitz. You know, I understand the argument against about privatizing the wine and spirits shop. Originally, their proposal was $2 billion. We're going to have this huge cash windfall, and they claimed we weren't going to lose anything. We were going to have a huge amount of money, and we were going to be able to spend that and wouldn't have to raise taxes. I kind of understand that. I kind of understand you might be enticed by that as much as the $2 billion number was BS.
Right.
You might be enticed by it. I'm not seeing that kind of enticement in this. I'm just seeing we're going to hand over control of this to somebody else, and they're going to eliminate a couple of hundred good-paying jobs with family-sustaining jobs that help our local economy, people who are dedicated to state work, and we don't know where that stuff's going to go. I don't see the enticement. Maybe, is there something I'm missing?
Well, when this idea came out, I think there were a lot of people who figured, well, weren't successful at privatizing the liquor system. They've made such a big deal about privatization in general that they had to find something. And they found this, even though there's absolutely no reason to privatize the lottery. That's the only thing I can think of, is that they're doing it for its own sake, even though that there's no real benefit to any of the stakeholders involved.
Pure ideology. Last question I've got for you. You know, one of the things that I've been focusing on, because I do believe the pension is going to be a huge issue, mm-hmm. and I see this as a pension ripoff as well. I see that as a stream of revenue for the company who's going to be taking over this. They're going to be able to screw with these workers' pensions in the future, not currently. But I just see that as another way of diminishing the money going into the state fund, and also giving a private corporation the ability to fiddle with these folks' wages and their lives into the future. And I'm not happy with it.
No, I agree. I think, you know, we are seeing across the country disrespect for the people who make our communities work. You know, in this case, it's the employees of the lottery, but you see it with teachers, with firefighters, with police officers, with, you know, labor at every level. And, you know, unfortunately, this is just one more example of that. And, you know, that's what my caucus and I are fighting against.
For our listeners, where and when is the meeting?
The hearing is Monday morning in the North Office Building, 10 a.m., the Senate Finance Committee.
All righty. Senator Rob Teplitz, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the input.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. You know, I look at this, and again, I go back to, I don't see the enticement here, folks. I just don't. You know, like I said, with the wine and spirit shops, there was some enticement. We got this big number. We reached behind us, reached in, dug real deep, and popped out a big number, $2 billion. And then as you started to unpeel it, you started going, well, wait, $2 billion? Where'd you come up with that number? Well, you know, we kind of just pulled it from the dark side of the moon. And then they came out, well, it's actually just 1.7. Well, and that's the real number. And then it was 1.5, and then it was 1, and then it was a half, it was 500 million, and it was, well, it doesn't matter. The money doesn't matter. It's core functions of government. We shouldn't be in that business. But what about the $2 billion? And I think the more you look at right-wing arguments, it's all about blind faith belief. It's all about hatred of we the people. It's that simple. Every one of these privatization schemes about hatred of you and me. Nothing can be ours. Everything has to be someone's. I mean, I've always said the Republicans have always been the very authoritarian party, and this just highlights that for me. That someone has to own it. We can't do it for ourselves because we're incapable. Because we're just the rabble, the unwashed masses. But we're the ones buying the tickets. We're the ones who should benefit from it. But I look at this, and I don't care what side of the political divide you're on, where on the spectrum you find yourself, you have got to be furious about how this governor has done this like a thief in the night. 4:30 on a Friday, as everyone's jetting out of town, as the big news media outlet here is covering the farm show. You know he didn't do it at the farm show. Quick break. Back with hour three.
Don't know much biology. Don't know much about the science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from dawn to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel reacted to the shooting at Taft High School Thursday by saying the California teachers have serious concerns about the increased number of school shootings in America. Vogel said the teachers' thoughts and best wishes for a speedy recovery go out to the student injured in that shooting. The California Teachers Association also commends the teacher and campus supervisor for their quick responses as they put themselves in harm's way to protect students. The CTA says this latest shooting reiterates the need for communities to come together to ensure we have safe learning environments for all students.
Some UAW workers unhappy with deteriorating working conditions at the Detroit 3 will be demonstrating across from the Detroit Auto Show over the weekend and Monday. Auto worker Caravan will be doing the protest. They say that the global restructuring of the Detroit 3 automakers has been on the backs of working people to maximize profits. When two of the Detroit 3 were rescued by the federal government, the restructuring meant that auto workers lost their annual cost of living adjustments, lost some break and holiday time, suffered a drop in overtime pay, while also allowing the companies to pay new hires lower wages. The auto worker Caravan workers say the American companies are adopting a Mexican maquiladora model for U.S. auto workers. The workers say that means using more temporary workers paid as little as $9 an hour, increasing the pace of assembly work, imposing alternative work schedules and flexible operating patterns that force workers into 10-hour-plus shifts, and being harassed by management when injured on the job. The workers are calling for a further restructuring of the U.S. auto industry to improve the deteriorating working conditions for auto workers while building much-needed clean, green vehicles and mass transit to meet national needs while creating good jobs. Organized labor leaders are praising the work of Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, who is resigning soon. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that Secretary Solis, quote, brought urgently needed change to the Department of Labor, putting the U.S. government firmly on the side of working families, end quote. He said Solis never lost sight of her working class roots and always put the values of working families at the center of everything she did. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa said Secretary Solis has been a strong advocate for working families throughout her public career, and as the daughter of a Teamsters shop steward, she learned early in life the value of a strong labor movement. Hoffa says she will be missed. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As we come marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are brightened by the beauty a sudden sun discloses. And the people hear us singing bread and roses. Bread and roses.
Well, today is the 101st anniversary of the bread and roses strike. And during the break, I got an email from Andy who said, absolutely, labor strife and management terror against the working class. Latimer, Ludlow, they've been purged from our grade school history textbooks. He says, we wouldn't know about these tragic injustices without people like the program here and extracurricular research. And, you know, I go and I say, look, you know, like Wisconsin, I wish every state would pass a law that said you have to at least have a semester of labor education so that we don't forget our past. And I remember when I had talked about the Latimer Massacre, which just happened not more than a half hour from here, the number of people who contacted me said, I didn't realize that was here. Labor stories cannot be forgotten, which is why when these anniversaries come up, I feel that I have to bring folks on to talk about it, which is why I have asked Professor Bob Forent of the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's a professor of history there and also the chairman of the Bread and Roses Centennial Committee, breadandrosescentennial.org, their website. We've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure.
You know, I look at the assault on really our history over the years and how they have done how some forces have done a masterful job of taking all of labor's history completely out of the textbooks.
Yeah, I teach labor history at the university, and usually my students come away surprised. They have no concept at all coming through high school. Not everybody, but most of them, that any of the things that they take for granted, you know, in terms of health and safety or minimum wage or Social Security, they have no concept of where any of that came from. It's almost like it's like the virgin birth to them. And so it's really what you're saying, is right on target. Listening to the report as I was waiting to come on of what the UAW was dealing with in Detroit, the description, you know, is very much like what the description was of what workers faced in 1912 in Lawrence, and so not a lot changes, even when we think of like the fire recently in Bangladesh and a textile mill, very much like what happened in New York in the Triangle Fire in March of 1911. So these things, there's a pattern here that just somehow, you're right, is missing from the textbook.
And for me, it's all about remembering the past and learning from it so that we don't have to continue to make the same mistakes, which I see us, you know, everything seems cyclical to me, and we seem to be right back in the good old days of the 90s.
I think it's funny. We have a really active Facebook site that we're going to keep up, even though the centennial sort of officially ends tomorrow. We're going to keep the Bren Rose's Centennial Facebook site up and do labor history. So you mentioned the Latimer Massacre. We've done that, Ludlow, all sorts of things, mining disasters and such. And quite often people, when something is there, they'll say, wow, I never knew this. I just guess I, you know, usually they'll say, I must have been sleeping during that history class or something. And I usually email back, no, you weren't sleeping. It wasn't taught. And I think right now we're in an area, I think, where the assault on the, you know, what's left in many ways of the labor movement, the large public sector unions, is really, you know, what's going on to try to roll us back, probably not even to the, more like to the 1890s.
Well, that's what I said. The good old days of the 90s.
I thought you meant the 1990s. The 1890s. That was bad enough. But, yeah, I mean, definitely, it's definitely a similar trend. And the teachers unions and, you know, nurses unions and things like that are on the front line, hotel unions, a lot of those workers are really, you know, facing lockouts and just, you know, bad bargaining and all sorts of things at this point.
Yeah, and, you know, the reality to me is all of these assaults on workers, all this whole no rights at work agenda is what I call it.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is just repeating what history has given us. And the assault on labor history is by design. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I was talking to people as they were closing, the school out, Charlie McAllister's school out there. What was that, Brett?
IUP,
Indiana University of Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
had a labor history center.
Yep.
Where they had archives. There was a school down in Alabama, University of UAB down there with Professor Feldman. They closed that down. There's been this assault on labor's
mm-hmm.
heritage.
UMass Boston is doing the same thing now with its labor studies program.
And it's all by design by the people, by the wealth class, who said, yeah, we'll give you money that you can, you know, do business stuff, but that labor stuff has to go.
Yeah, and again, it's taken so much of the emphasis now in high school with all of these standardized tests and things, and that's the justification of the argument for less and less history of any kind. And so if kids get history at all, it's sort of a straight-up, very traditional U.S. history survey course with very little focus. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I talk a lot about when I talk, I've gone around during the centennial year, I've probably done 75 or 100 talks on the strike, and a lot of them in middle schools and high schools and such, and really talk about the strike as really, this was the community on strike against the mill owners. It wasn't just a group of workers who worked in the mills. It was the entire community, and that's why the strike was successful. And so I think, for me at least, one of the takeaways as someone who teaches and writes labor history is really that's where we need to go again, I think, in terms of lessons learned, for me at least, from the centennial. We need much more broad-based activity. It can't just be the workers in a particular factory. These really need to be seen much more as community activities than just simply a specific workplace.
Well, which is why for the last 30, 40 years we've been fed this, you know, we're individuals. We're not part of a community. Hooray for me and the heck with everybody else mentality. To get away from that kind of community. And take me back 101 years ago today. What were the conditions of these workers there in Lowell? What were the workers, what were these, mostly women, I understand, right?
Yeah, well, Lowell was cotton mills, Lawrence was woolen mills, and so, actually, after the strike in Lawrence in 1912, there was an equally
big
strike in Lowell that never got the same sort of treatment, so I'm resurrecting that one, too. But in Lawrence, on the eve of the strike in 1912, the working conditions were really quite dangerous. Just in the week leading up to the strike, there had been several really horrific accidents. When you read the local newspapers for the time, life expectancy, Lawrence had one of the worst infant mortality rates in the country, one of the highest death rates for kids under five. If you were a spinner in the woolen mills in Lawrence and you started work when you were 16, the odds were pretty high that you wouldn't make it out of your 30s. You would develop lung ailments of one sort or another. People were paid, you know, really miserable wages, the equivalent in today's money of about $2.10 an hour for a 56-hour week. So just really difficult. The key thing, I think, one of the fallacies in the way people have talked about the strike is even now a lot of people, when they write about it, who are writing labor history, will see the strike as some sort of a really heroic, spontaneous kind of an activity. There was a wage cut at the beginning of 1912. The legal work week went from 56 to 54 hours in
right.
Massachusetts. But people knew months in advance that that was going to happen, and there had been a tremendous amount of organizing in Lawrence for months and months before the first payday, which was January 11, January 12 of 1912. There had been block by block, immigrant neighborhood by immigrant neighborhood organizing. There were over 40 nationalities in Lawrence, and the commitment was made early on in that organizing process that everything would be done in multiple languages, all meetings would be conducted in multiple languages. So there was
no English only.
Pardon me.
No English only.
No, definitely not. Had it been English only, the strike would have lasted about a half a day.
Because
even outdoor meetings, they had big outdoor meetings on the Lawrence Common, and it's the middle of winter in New England. And those meetings, people would be translating. So a group of workers who understood Italian would stand together, and if somebody was speaking from the bandstand in French, somebody who understood French and Italian would be simultaneously translating to a group of workers into Italian so they would know what was going on. And that would happen sequentially all over the Lawrence Common while people were meeting, so that everybody really felt part of the decision-making process. There was a very large, about a 50-person strike committee that made lots of decisions, and it was very representative of all the groups in the city. And the industrial workers of the world had been active in Lawrence for a few years. Before the strike, there were at least a dozen foreign language IWW locals in the city of Lawrence that had about 4,000 members on the eve of the strike. So there was a real big organization. There was a very powerful network of organizers and people. So people were ready for the eventuality, should their wages be cut when they got their pay that morning on the 11th and then on the 12th. Again, it wasn't some magical thing like, oh my goodness, 25,000 people walked out. They were very well prepared. They had soup kitchens already. They had doctors volunteering their time, nurses volunteering their time. There was an incredible network set up, and it really was very much a community on strike.
And as I remember, there was some violence, and you know, families were actually sending kids away because it had gotten violent, and not from the strikers' point of view.
Yeah, no, a woman, Anna Lapizzo, was 34 years old, was shot in the streets during a demonstration, and lost her life. And another young striker, a teenager named John Ramey, was stabbed with a militia bayonet and lost his life as well. And lots of people were arrested, were thrown in jail for rallying and picketing. The IWW, Bill Haywood, when he was there, and a number of other organizers were very clear in all the rallies telling the workers to strike with their hands in their pockets, because they knew that any provocative act would really bring even more reprisals. And so, yeah, eventually by February, early in February, so the strike had been going on for about a month, workers started sending their children away to sympathetic families. Barre, Vermont was one of the first places where a number of kids went, then Philly and New York, and several hundred kids ultimately were sent away for the latter part of the strike for safe feeding and safekeeping.
Now, you hear that, and you know, you can't imagine that's my country.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was pretty. We have incredible photos on the Facebook site of the kids at the train station being sent away, and then these incredible photos we found of the parades in Lawrence when the strike ends and the kids come back, all this incredible sort of rejoicing and reuniting of families at the train station as the kids who have been scattered all around the East Coast are brought back. But the sending away of the kids was actually the first time the tactic had been used to at least for what we understand, maybe not. Maybe it happened someplace else, but we think it was, if not the first, one of the first times it happened in a strike in the U.S. But it had been a common tactic in Europe, and a lot of the immigrant workers who ended up coming to Pennsylvania, coal country, or whatever, or New England, brought a lot of their own strike activity and knowledge with them. And so this was really something that workers in Lawrence thought about, you know, because they had done it themselves and they had been in similar situations in Europe. And so it really, it was very effective. It garnered a lot of publicity for the strike. And the mill owners overreached. They were upset that the strikers were getting the upper hand in the media war with sending the kids away. Like when they got to New York, there would be these huge rallies at the train station and stuff and big parades in New York City for the kids and all of that. And so on a morning in late February, they were trying to send some kids to Philadelphia, and the militia decided no more kids were leaving, and they beat up a number of women and kids and arrested everybody from the train station in downtown Lawrence, and that turned public opinion further against the mill owners and the militia, and shortly thereafter Congress called for hearings and an investigation into what was happening, and then the strike was settled pretty quickly after that.
So let me ask you, I got about 2 minutes left. You know, bring that to 101 years forward to today. What lessons do we learn from it now?
Well, I think the first lesson is that workers need to build strong community support. I think the movements from just a little while ago with Justice for Janitors, some of the organizing that's going on in Massachusetts for nurses, hotel worker unionization, I think people realize that living wage campaigns, I think that unions need to really talk about the role that they play in producing, you know, a decent standard of living and a quality of life for not just their individual members, but a strong union community is actually a good place to live. And I think we've not, as a movement, we've not really done that well, and I think that that's, for me, one of the lessons learned, that's one. And the second thing, I think, is that, as I was saying earlier, with multi-language organizing and the respect for different communities and their cultures and stuff was really instrumental in helping create the solidarity for the strike in Lawrence. We need to do that as well. We can't get sucked into it. You know, somebody who looks different than us fault that we're not getting a decent wage.
That's and I want English only. English only.
Yeah. That's not going to do it for us. Absolutely not.
And you know what I've been saying for the longest time is, you know, the fact that the textile jobs, the factory jobs, the mine jobs, you know, the truck driving jobs, all of those jobs that my grandparents' generation made, middle class jobs, they started off as today's fast food jobs, today's domestic worker, today's home health care aide, and what these folks did 101 years ago, the kind of things we need to start doing today, organizing, getting out in the streets, and demanding a decent wage.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, my dad was a meat cutter for 40 years. And so, I mean, that's the sort of tradition, you know, that I come from. And I think, you know, I was the first person in my family to be able to go to college. And now I see all these kids in my classes at the university with this massive debt and, you know, being unable to afford actually to go to college and whatever. And somehow we've sort of skipped over that history of sort of how we were able to get to that point. And it's really, it's too bad. I mean, hopefully it will change. Sometimes I'm optimistic, sometimes not in trying to figure this out, but I definitely gather inspiration from things like the strike in Lawrence. There's no question about that.
Professor Forint, I appreciate the time. I'd love to have you back and talk about this some more at some point in the future.
Anytime. You know how to find me. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Gonna work on Maggie's farm no more.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Looking back at 2012, who was the nuttiest political fruitcake of all? Donnie Trump, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich instantly come to mind, but they're pros at the nutball game, so naming them is unfair to some of the amateur talent that burst on the scene at year's end. For example, Wayne the Insane LaPierre. This honcho of the NRA came completely unwrapped during a December press conference. In a tremulous voice, the gun industry lobbyist delivered a rambling 25-minute tirade. He assailed anyone who suggests that the sickening assault weapon slaughter of 6-year-old school kids in Connecticut should prompt us to ban those senseless weapons of mass killing. Rather, ranted LaPierre, the answer is more guns, turning American schools into armed fortresses. If that's crazy, Wayne concluded, then call me crazy. Yet, even Crazy Wayne wasn't 2012's top nut, for he was nipped at the last moment by a 7-man pod of nuts known as the Iowa Supreme Court. On December 21, this all-male court voted 7-0 to decree that, get ready to be whopper-jawed, a male boss may legally fire a female employee for no reason except that he finds her sexually irresistible. Try to get your mind around that. Even though she was not flirtatious, had no interest in him, and had been a stellar worker, she was ruled to be at fault because the boss man can't control his lust. The learned men of the bench insisted that she was not fired because of her gender, but because of his feelings. So it was not discrimination, but merely an act by the boss to save his marriage. Another victory for family values. This is Jim Hightower saying, never mind that he was saving his marriage from himself, not from her. They say that justice is blind, but in Iowa, it's just plain nutty. For their supreme spasm of sublime nuttiness, we award 7 fruitcakes to the Iowa court. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The wall.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, get the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. So the owners of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, they're threatening to liquidate the company if those workers don't take pay cuts and, basically don't give up everything. if you don't give up everything you fought for the last 30, 40 years, we're going to liquidate. And I'm of the mindset, let them liquidate. That's where I would stand on it. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Rick, how are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
Gee, I hope your grandmother's feeling okay too.
Fortunately, we're getting better. Very very happy with the progress. Thank you for asking.
Great. You're lucky to have one still around.
My last one. Both of my parents are gone. She's my the last of the parental line.
Yeah. I miss mine. Having Bill Black on, man, that guy is the truth teller.
Yeah, he's out.
God, he's got all the facts, the figures, the history. Guy's great.
Yeah, and the thing that bothers me with the political paradigm that we have now is when it comes to the economic stuff, they're both in the same. They're feeding from the same trough, which then makes me think more. We've got to get money out of politics.
Oh man, I almost popped my gourd when Jack Lew was announced. God, it was just so awful. Because like Bill Black said, this guy is the architect of the destruction of our financials. A Reubenite. Complete deregulator in Alan Greenspan's back pocket.
Yeah, do you think he was the architect, though?
The whole nine yards.
Let me walk back on that for a second, Andy. Do you think he was the architect or the lackey that was brought along by the architects? Because, the more I look at it, the way, Professor Black laid it out is, this guy was a failure everywhere he went. So, kind of like in the Geithner mold, he's a Summers Rubin protege. I was, I got to be honest. I was thinking he's going to dig up Larry Summers and bring him back.
Yeah. That'd be just wonderful, too. There's another. He was one of the main guys were Greenspan, Phil Graham, and Robert Rubin. And then you can put Summers in there, too. Those guys are really the architects. You're correct. A guy like Lou is really just a lackey and just a follow-on and just a type of guy. He's the type of guy that will do anything, a yes man, anything to get ahead in life. He's a lawyer. He's not a finance guy. Yep. Same thing as Timmy Geithner. These guys are just sycophants. They're fawning. They're like leeches. You know, they just hang on. They suck the blood of our system. And they have no morals, no integrity, no ethics. The working man be damned. You know, us, we're nothing. There's no integrity there. It's all about me getting ahead, right? And it's making your boss happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's another example. Like George Carlin always said, it's a big club, and you and I are not in the big club.
Exactly. And that's why a guy like Bill Black is on the outside. That's why he probably quit. You could tell. He's the type of guy that suffers no fools. You know, no fools. If somebody in the government tells him that your customer is the banks, he probably just went, that's it. I can't survive in this environment. The guy I'm supposed to be regulating is my customer? What kind of message is that?
Well, what bothers me, and we brought it up a little bit when I talked to him, is my future employer is the guy I'm regulating. There's a huge problem. I have a huge problem with that because you're not thinking, hey, how do I hold this guy in check? You're thinking, how can I appease him so he thinks I'm good enough to be hired and then make the six-figure salaries?
Right. It's an enormous conflict of interest. It's a swinging door. You know, like you said, getting money out of politics. Well, how about getting the jobs out of politics? Out of politics too.
Yeah, I mean,
they should be banned from going into anywhere close to somebody they were supposed to be regulating.
I look at
that guy Kurzami too, who just quit from the SEC. The top Kurzami, he was the top litigator. He was with Deutsche Bank. He was one of their top lawyers, and then he goes into the SEC, and now he's back out again. But let's see where he lands. What big Wall Street bank land after being with Deutsche Bank into the SEC, then back out again. Same thing with Mary Shapiro. Let's see where she finally lands.
No,
she's pretty old, but
I point to Billy Towson, the former congressman from Louisiana.
Big pharma
runs through the drug bill, does the arm twisting to get big pharma's agenda done. Then he turns out to be their CEO in the middle of his term. Didn't even wait to finish out his term. Resigned, quit, took the six-figure job, and, well, screw you, the people.
Well, look at that fool from South Carolina, the senator, going over to the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah.
Jim DeMint, right? I mean, same thing. Does the dirty work for the plutocracy, for the Koch brothers? And there's your reward, baby. I'm going to make you money. It's the same way as Timmy Geithner. Let's see where Timmy Geithner lands, too.
It'll be back to
Wall
Street.
Doing the dirty work.
It'll be back to Wall Street.
Exactly.
And at some point, how do you stop that? Do you pass a law saying you can't work for the industry for X amount of years, and is that constitutional?
You got to. Look at Brooksley Bourne. I mean, let's bring her back too. Get her on the show, Rick. Let's hear her story. She's written a book too.
During the break, we were actually talking about how do we go back and get her, because there was a while we were talking about her, because the whole Greenspan quote that I used came out of that conversation. That, you know, the regulators just aren't smart enough to regulate these really complex issues. And my thought at the time when I heard it is, if they're that complex, we shouldn't be fiddling with them.
That whole thing with the credit default swaps was such a joke. And that was done in the Commodities Futures Modernization Act of 2000. The regulation went through, and that was, again, Bill Graham and the Greenspan stuff that let that go through, and Clinton signed it. But Lou had something to do with that, too. But that opened up AIG to sell these credit default swaps without any reserves.
Yep.
Nothing behind it.
But they're...
And then that swine, Maurice Greenberg, wants a lawsuit saying he lost $25 billion in that deal.
Yeah, but thank you. Thank you, Andy. But thank you. I don't know. You know, it's angering, it's frustrating, and what it does is, to me, it highlights that you and me and everybody else had better wake up and start electing people that have our interest in mind. And while there are some things I agree with Obama on, there's a lot of things I don't. But here's where I'll leave this. He's still a hell of a lot better than Romney would have been on just about everything else. I think they'd have been just about the same on this, though.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and Bill Black said the same thing. I mean, there's no doubt Romney was, and you know, you're talking full-throttle fascism there.
Yeah.
Full-throttle plutocracy, corporatism there. At least Obama, you have some hope that maybe we can push him. But I'll tell you, working through the political system and working through the Democratic Party, and I've been doing it for years. God, is it tough, man.
Yep. Got to get in the streets.
It's tough because they don't want you. They don't want progressives there, man.
Nope. Got to get in the streets. Got to make the noise. Andy, I got to take a quick break here. I appreciate the time, though, brother.
And that's the only way, Rick. You got it.
I'm with you.
Take care. Hope your grandma feels better.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Bye-bye.
Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
For the homeless, for the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game? From the master of the cloak and dagger.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth, sky.
On June 30th, 1908, in a remote part of Russia, people saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky.
Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia. It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations for the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30th, 1908. If it were an asteroid, it might have been about a third as big as a football field.
The object probably never struck Earth. Instead, it appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above the Siberia wilderness. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Tunguska or airburst. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And by the way, what we shouldn't do, I just got to say this, what we shouldn't be doing is trying to take away your rights to bargain for better wages or working together.
Employee Free Choice Act, that would have been helpful. In fact, you know, I said that probably been, it should have been the first piece of legislation passed, and I know a lot of people, oh, Lilly Ledbetter, that should have been it, so we could have prevented Lilly Ledbetter in the future. Just a thought. Now that I see Hilda Solis has resigned, moving on, and you know, hey, I wish her nothing but the best. I thought she did an outstanding job. President Obama hasn't really signaled who her replacement will be. A lot of theories out there. Perhaps, you know, the Solicitor of Labor, Patricia Smith. There's a thought, someone whose thought seems to be on the short list. So we want to talk a little bit about her past as working in the Labor Department there in New York. So I've asked Melanie Willingham-Jaggers, organizer with Align, the Alliance for Greater New York, to come talk to us about Ms. Smith's time there at the New York Department of Labor. Patricia, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, hey, how are you?
Oh, Melanie, thanks for taking time for me. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got this screen in front of me, and when I look at this, for some reason tonight I have just got this weird thing that when I see something, it just pops out of my mouth. It's stupid.
So I appreciate you having me on.
I appreciate you taking time for me. You know, I look at Secretary Solis, and I think she did a fantastic job. A lot of things that I'm very pleased with. Some things I wish she'd have done a little bit more on. But hopefully the next person will pick up the ball. You know, misclassification of workers to me is a huge thing. I'm curious, while Ms. Smith was at the New York Labor Department, what was her record like?
Hey, you and me both. We really appreciate Henda Solis for what she did. I think that in terms of Patricia Smith, we really believe that she's an excellent choice for the Secretary of Labor because for over 30 years she's been a champion of workers, especially the vulnerable and low-skilled workers. So in 2009, we here at Align honored Patricia Smith for her work on preventing wage theft, worker misclass, and exploitation of immigrant workers while she was with the New York Department of Labor. As the New York Labor Commissioner, she developed a reputation as one of the nation's foremost labor commissioners because of her vigorous efforts to crack down on minimum wage and overtime violations at businesses, including restaurants.
So,
she did a number of really great things.
Yeah, so the question then becomes, you know, I compare Hilda Solis to Elaine Chao Chao Chao, and I go completely different world views, completely different paymasters. Hilda Solis actually stood up for workers, as were Chao. Well, she was bought and paid for by the wealth class. I want someone who's going to help the low-wage worker, the people who's working at the fast food restaurants, the people who are struggling, taking care of people in their homes. I want to make sure that those are the folks that are being looked after. And from what I understand, the reading that I've done and what you've just said, Patricia Smith seems to fit the bill as I'm looking for.
She definitely does. So Henda Solis is going down the right path, right? She recovered a record $280 million in pay, right, for 300,000 workers in 2012. Her predecessor, Elaine Chao, did a number of things wrong under a president who did a number of things wrong. So Bush was anti-union, and so was she. Right? She opposed the increase in minimum wage, and the minimum wage increased anyway, thank goodness. She opposed affirmative action. She supported changes in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which would have cut 8 million workers' overtime pay, and the change did not pass because of the organizing that we did here on the ground. Right? So we know that Elaine Chao went the wrong direction, and we really think that Patricia Smith will go the right direction in terms of what we want to see. And, you know, I have to say that the Secretary of Labor is not a high visibility position, but it has a tremendous impact on the lives of working families all over the country.
Oh, absolutely.
And so while it might not be a glamorous position for people to take on, we know that we need a good quality person that's going to be pro-labor, pro-worker, pro-us, pro-American family in this position for workers all over the country because it impacts every single person who has a job in this country. If we're going to have a champion, it's going to be someone like Patricia Smith.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I remember going back to Bob Reich when he was working and when he was the labor secretary under Clinton and finally got out because Clinton wouldn't let him do anything. And I remember reading his book,
right,
Locked in the Cabinet, where they would let him do nothing. And I look at Obama and I wonder how much of that has, you know, how much of the leaning back on Secretary Solis has led to her decision to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, again, we need someone who's going to be a champion. And with all the hindrances that she might have had in her position, we really feel like she's been an advocate, right, for workers. She has, like I said, she recovered a record $280 million, right, for 300,000 workers just last year. Her focus on wage and hour enforcement has been particularly useful for working families, especially beneficial for vulnerable workers, including immigrants, teens and workers who are misclassified as independent contractors. And we need someone who is going to be more pro-worker than they are pro-business. And we know that that is, we think, Patricia Smith.
Yeah, you know, for me, I one of the big issues going forward that I think is the worker misclassification, this use of independent contractors,
right.
So that we can pull the conditions down, because we know when they hire independent contractors, they're generally not paying unemployment or workers' comp or Social Security or any of that stuff. And so that, what's happening is they're pulling all of us down. And I want someone who's going to say, enough of this already. We need to change. We need to repair our labor laws and stop this misclassification and a lot of the other stuff going on.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, in terms of, the police, you know, we have someone who stood up for this misclassification of workers. And we really have to, and particularly here in New York, we know the danger, right, with truck drivers and many other kinds of workers, that if you have to, you know, pay out of your pocket for the lease and the maintenance of a truck, for example, right, a semi, that's going to cut into not only what you have to bring home, but how you're able to do your work, right? So we know that we need someone, again, who is more pro-worker than they are pro-business. We need someone who's more pro-labor than they are pro-business. And so until we have that as a nominee for Secretary of Labor, that we know that Obama needs to come toward us more so than we need to come toward him.
Yeah, I just read a report today from the folks over at the Center for Progressive Reform. They were talking about contingent workers who, fill hazardous jobs and the injury rates that are through the roof and how, you know, all of the things that are going on, that they suffer injuries and higher death rates and all of this stuff, and that we need to be changing how we're classifying workers, protect them as much as protecting their paychecks, protecting their health as well.
Absolutely. I think an important piece of what we're also sort at here at Align really is around HIDRA protecting the more than 2 million workers in terms of the Caring Cross Generations campaign. So many of your listeners may have already sent their comments in to the Department of Labor in support of the changes to the Department of Labor regulations, the Fair Labor Standards Act. Earlier this year, early in 2012. But really, you know, in terms of Hilda Solis and the next Department of Labor heads, eye on, you know, what's going to be fair in terms of labor standards. And so a key example of this is the companionship exemption, which exempts home care workers and home care attendants from overtime and minimum wage laws. And so it's things like this, small little pieces of the law, right, that extend to millions and millions of workers across this country, that keep them from making minimum wage, that keep them from being paid overtime payments, that keep quality folks out of these jobs and keep people who are working these jobs, who are so important to our economy, so important to our families, away from dignity and away from what they deserve as full-time workers. Home care workers are often listed as exempt employees or as independent contractors. And that's, number one, false, but two, doesn't recognize them for the amount of quality work that they do for our families and our homes, and keep the rest of us able to work outside of our homes while they're at home taking care of our most valued loved ones.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and for me, that's the fight of the next couple of years, because as we see the baby boom generation moving into their golden years, you're going to want to be able to keep those folks in their home longer, and not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's cost effective. We can't be putting people in nursing homes. And I know, like, my grandmother, who's going through an illness right now, they wanted to put her in a nursing home, and the family's like, no, we want her at home where she belongs.
Listen, home care are often the lifeline for seniors and people with disabilities. If your listeners want to hear more, they should go to caringacrossgenerations.org. Again, that's caringacrossgenerations.org, because we're looking to create 2 million jobs for direct care workers that have fair pay and benefits, along with the right to organize and training and career ladders, but also offer our loved ones, right, seniors and people with disabilities, the right to age in place, to live in their own home, and afford them the dignity and respect that they deserve, right, in their golden years. But we know, right, as you and I know this, your listeners know this, that the people who do the work to support our loved ones are just as important as our loved ones themselves. They deserve dignity and respect in the work that they do. So Caring Across Generations is a great organization. It's a great campaign, and folks should go to the website just to learn more. But we know that with this campaign, we are not only ensuring mom and dad and grandma and grandpa the right to live at home and age in place and age with dignity, but we're also ensuring that the people that take care of them, right, a workforce who is majority women, who are many, many women of color, who are many, many immigrant workers, the right to have a job that has dignity and that has respect themselves. And so we know this is very important, and it's not at all anything that's isolated. We know that we all have to come to the table together and fight for dignity, both for ourselves and for each other.
I'm right there with you. But let me ask you, is this something that the Secretary of Labor would have control over, or is this something that they could do?
So if you ask me, I would tell you that President Obama could snap his fingers right now and make this change. And we hope that he'll do that. We flooded the Department of Labor office as well with thousands and thousands of comments in support of this change to the Department of Labor regulation. And over a year, we've been waiting on President Obama to be our champion. We know that Hilda Solis was on our side and was our champion. And we know that the next person who is the head of the Department of Labor needs to also be our champion. And that's why we're supporting Patricia Smith.
Outstanding. The website again was?
CaringAcrossGenerations.org.
And we'll get a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can click on Melanie's name. It'll take you right there. Melanie, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Yanley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Yanley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Yanley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms, crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU.
Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Most of them are not in sympathy with the union. There's a small group in the union that is that, and that's typical of an organization like that. It's typical of a Congress. It's typical of unions. It's typical of companies, I guess. The NRA is another place where the membership, if you do the polling, doesn't agree with the leadership.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the big numbers are out. Yep, the trade numbers are out. And look, yeah, you know what it's going to be. We have another month of trade deficits. In fact, our international trade deficit in goods and services has risen to, well, for the month of November, up $48.7 billion, up from just the month before in October of $42.1 billion in trade deficits. The one that I keep an eye on quite often, the trade deficit that we have with China, slightly down. We just bought $29 billion more of goods and services from the Chinese in the month of November than they bought from us. In fact, October had been the all-time high, the top of the mountain, $29.5 billion trade deficit there. So we are on pace to obliterate the record trade deficit with China, which sits at $295 billion, which was 2011. We right now, somewhere in the neighborhood of $290 billion. That was just through November. So when the December numbers come in, which will probably be in the 29 to 30, hopefully not more than that, billion-dollar range, we will go right on by $295 billion. And, you know, for all of the talk of we're going to rebuild manufacturing and all of the talk of we care about our deficits and all of our talk of, oh, but Rick, we've got a debt problem. We're going to be Greece. For all of that talk and all the histrionics and all of that BS, I don't see anyone, really, I don't see anyone talking about our insane trade policies. And, you know, a little earlier we talked with Professor Bill Black, and, you know, one of the things I would have loved to have gotten into him with, and at some point in the future I'm going to bring him back, you know, talk about this whole neoliberal trade policy that's been going on since the late 70s. Where they said, look, the wealth class of this country and this world said, look, those workers are getting uppity. They think they deserve a decent wage. They think they're entitled to health care. They think they should have a retirement. And for me, you know, part of that American dream is being able to support my family, to not worry in my final years if I'm going to have to eat cat food or choose between cat food and medicine, that I'm going to have some retirement security, some health security, that in our working years we're going to do okay. But the more I see coming around, the policies I see coming really out of both parties, to be honest, but more so the conservative Republican pro-business mentality groups. And look, hey, the DLC Democrats are just as bad as the most pro-business Republican. They're on the same page. And as we talked with Professor Black, look, you know, I don't see Lou any different as I see Geithner, and I didn't see Geithner any different than the rest of them. It's all about how do you, and you, look, what frustrates me is all of these schemes. All of the, oh, let's deregulate the banks and see what happens again. And, oh, let's, you know, let's screw with how we regulate this or that. At the end of the day, who ends up holding the bag? You and I do. And you could go, oh, it's just bad government. And I would tend to agree. But that's not the answer, to have no government. Because, look, at the end of the day, no government would be even worse. You know, the Wild West was not a wonderful, you know, there's a lot of people who, oh, it was wonderful. No. We don't want a financial industry like the Wild West, because we lose. At the end of the day, the taxpayer always loses. So when I see Corbett here doing away with the lottery, I mean, think this through to the rational conclusion. Think of where this could end up. Like in Illinois, the company didn't hit their projections, and now they don't want to pay. So now you're going to have to sue them. And next year, they may not hit their projections. They're not going to pay. You may have to sue them. And eventually down the road, it gets to the point where the company has extracted so much money and you have spent so much money on trying to go after them that eventually they just walk away. So who's then left holding the bag? Oh, yeah, we are. And then guess what happens? You don't have the infrastructure. And this is the part that nobody's talking about. Once you get rid of all of those workers who are doing that job right now, once you have gotten rid of them, how do you start it back up again? You can't. Or you lose a ton of money in the process. And the taxpayers, again, are on the hook. So when I look at all of this, I get angry and very frustrated that we should be learning these lessons. And, you know, you go back to the SNL debacle. You go back to that and you go, why didn't we learn our lesson then? How is it we've had more and more and more of these bank crises? Didn't we learn from the Depression? Oh, yeah, we did. We passed Glass-Steagall. And then they unpassed it. And look what it's gotten us. So why didn't we say, well, you know, Glass-Steagall worked. Let's re-implement that. Put that clear dividing line. Banks should not be gambling houses. But we haven't done that either. And then what you've done is you've created a regulatory body that, I'm sorry, you know, it doesn't have the teeth. So what you end up with, you end up with a scenario like we talked about. The regulators come in. They think of the people that they're overseeing, the cop on the street, as their customers, their clients. Because, hey, that's where I'm going to work. As soon as this president's gone, man, I'm going. I'm going right over there. Or, you know, as soon as I get a couple years experience, I'm going into the industry, going to make the big bucks. Instead of having career regulators. And this is why I've always been a fan of doing away with patronage and giving workers collective bargaining rights so that they can bargain for a decent job so that they stay. I want boring, non-political regulators who are going to follow the letter of the law and do what they're supposed to do, instead of political appointees who are looking for the next step upward. That's how we've gotten into this mess, and that's how you and I have gotten screwed. And at the end of the day, until we start focusing this discussion in the right direction, I think, like I said at the beginning, our trade policy should be the number one thing we focus on. You know when the last time as a nation we had a trade surplus was? As a whole, as a nation? 1975. We have been losing jobs that entire time. Gotta take a quick break. Back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. California Teachers Association President Dean Vogel reacted to the shooting at Taft High School Thursday by saying the California teachers have serious concerns about the increased number of school shootings in America.
Vogel said the teacher's thoughts and best wishes for a speedy recovery go out to the student injured in that shooting. The California Teachers Association also commends the teacher and campus supervisor for their quick responses as they put themselves in harm's way to protect students. The CTA says this latest shooting reiterates the need for communities to come together to ensure we have safe learning environments for all students. Some UAW workers unhappy with deteriorating working conditions at the Detroit 3 will be demonstrating across from the Detroit Auto Show over the weekend and Monday. Auto worker Caravan will be doing the protest. They say that the global restructuring of the Detroit 3 automakers has been on the backs of working people to maximize profits. When two of the Detroit 3 were rescued by the federal government, the restructuring meant that auto workers lost their annual cost of living adjustments, lost some break and holiday time, suffered a drop in overtime pay, while also allowing the companies to pay new hires lower wages. The auto worker Caravan workers say the American companies are adopting a Mexican maquiladora model for U.S. auto workers. The workers say that means using more temporary workers paid as little as $9 an hour, increasing the pace of assembly work, imposing alternative work schedules and flexible operating patterns that force workers into 10-hour-plus shifts, and being harassed by management when injured on the job. The workers are calling for a further restructuring of the U.S. auto industry to improve the deteriorating working conditions for auto workers while building much-needed clean, green vehicles and mass transit to meet national needs while creating good jobs. Organized labor leaders are praising the work of Labor Secretary Hilda Solis, who is resigning soon. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that Secretary Solis, quote, brought urgently needed change to the Department of Labor, putting the U.S. government firmly on the side of working families, end quote. He said Solis never lost sight of her working class roots and always put the values of working families at the center of everything she did. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa said Secretary Solis has been a strong advocate for working families throughout her public career, and as the daughter of a Teamsters shop steward, she learned early in life the value of a strong labor movement. Hoffa says she will be missed. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers, the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy, through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the third hour of the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So yesterday, the mayor in Boston declared a public health emergency. Turned out that they have, the city itself has 700 confirmed cases of the flu so far. Last year they had 70 confirmed cases, so they're saying, hey, we've got a real problem. And last night I said, don't be surprised if in the coming days you see the CDC say this is officially an epidemic. Well, congratulations. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention today made it official. They are declaring this an epidemic. Evidently, it has passed the threshold of 7.3% of deaths from influenza or pneumonia. You've got 47 states now reporting widespread activity. My wife called me, you know, before the show and said, should we get a flu shot? And I'm like, well, go ahead. Do what you got to do. But here's the thing. What the CDC is saying is if you have symptoms, you know, you start to feel the symptoms, stay home. Get some rest. Here's the problem. Most people don't have paid sick days, can't get off work, and a good number of people have been reported being threatened. If they take time off, they're going to be fired, and some have been fired, which is why I do believe we absolutely need a campaign across this country to get people paid sick days, which is why I've asked Carol Joyner, National Policy Director for the Labor Project for Working Families, to come talk to us. Carol, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick. How are you?
I am good. Fortunately, I don't have the flu. You know,
neither
you look at this.
Do I.
You know, my wife calls me in a tizzy. I just saw this. It's an epidemic. Should we get shots? And I'm going, two things. First, I'm going, relax. You know, we're still relatively young. If we did it, we'll be okay. And two, you know, hey, you know, my fear is they're wrapping people up in a tizzy to go out and get flu shots.
Yeah. And it is an epidemic. They haven't seen anything like this in years.
So,
people being warned to get a flu shot and to wash their hands more than any other year. And, as you said, to stay home if they're sick. But there's a huge problem with staying home if you're sick.
Yeah, I mean,
most people don't have paid sick days.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and I've been fortunate through the vast majority of my working life. I've been a member of a labor union. I was a Teamster for more than 20 years. I've always had paid sick days. So when someone says, you know, you're sick, stay home, I go, okay, if I'm sick, I'm going to stay home. I don't want to get everybody else sick. But this concept of I'm going to be fired if I do, completely foreign to me. And I do believe, Carol, should be foreign to every worker.
Well, 40% of the general population doesn't have a single paid sick day. And it's even worse among low-wage workers, half the population of low-wage workers, and 80% of tip workers, meaning people who work in restaurants, servers, don't have a single paid sick day. And folks still walk around saying, well, I didn't know anyone didn't have a paid sick day. And here you are interacting with the public in a big way, and those folks don't have paid sick days. It's really tragic.
Yeah, I talked about that the other day. You know, my wife and I, we go out to eat quite often. I work a lot of hours, and you know, sometimes we can steal away for breakfast when the kids are in school before I go to work. And you know, I was saying, you know, the woman who's serving me, or the cook who's making the food, or whoever, I don't want them, you know, sneezing or wiping their nose. Not that they want to; it's because they have to. I don't want them anywhere near me because I don't want to get sick.
Well, yeah, it's restaurant workers, it's school bus drivers, daycare workers, nursing home workers working with elderly or people with compromised immune systems, retail workers. Most retail workers do not have a single paid sick day. These are folks who have high contact with the public. And as you said, they are forced oftentimes to come to work sick, or they can't afford to stay home, you know, because they won't get paid if they stay home and take care of their child when the child is sick. A few years ago, when the city of Seattle won paid sick days, as a few other ordinances have as well, when they won paid sick days, they actually gave testimony from nurses, school nurses, who said that the children would cry like crazy when they were told that their parents have to come get them when they're sick. And they were crying not because they were sick. They were crying because they knew that if their parents were called in to come get them, that their parents could lose their job.
Yeah.
And that would be much more devastating than their discomfort for a couple of hours or days.
You know, I hear that. And, you know, I think about my conservative friends who talk about family values.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I listen to that and you go, well, where's the family value in that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And generally,
I mean, to your point, a University of Chicago study showed recently that one out of four workers have been either fired or retaliated against in other ways for staying home to care for themselves or a sick child. And I don't think there's family values in that at all.
I mean, and even beyond the fact of paid sick days, you know, you look at the fact that, you know, what we've done with a lot of other things. You know, we have this Family Leave Act, and I personally have used the Family Leave Act. When my kids were born, I took several weeks off to welcome them into the world. But I was fortunate. I made a sufficient living that I could save a little bit of money. There's no pay in this. And I'm going, you know, on that family values frame, you know, when you're sick, when you're taking care of a loved one, when you're bringing a new child into the world, I'm sorry. My family value is I want to encourage that, so I want to make sure people can afford to do it.
So do you know that this is the 20th anniversary of the Family Medical Leave Act, what you and I both enjoyed when we had kids?
Which is why
this
I brought it
20th
up.
20th year. Is that Bill Clinton signed it into office in 1993.
Yeah, and they fought tooth and nail to make sure that there was no compensation in it. Because to me, at the time, I was arguing we should just tie it to unemployment so that when you go and you take those weeks, it's just like unemployment. And we pay into it, and we make sure that people have the ability to use it, and it's there as a safety net as well. But, you know, more importantly, when the kids are born, I mean, I'll... Everybody I talk to who are prospective parents, I say, you got to spend those first weeks together.
That's right.
It's so important for the bonding for the child. It's so important for the family. And yet, you know, politically, that's dead in the water.
Yeah, I don't understand the obstacles clearly. I mean, I get it from a political standpoint, but when you look at the fact that 177 other countries have some form of paid family leave, 177 other countries, most other countries, and we consider ourselves to be among the first world economically competitive, and we're unable to do this basic provision for families, for children, to nurture a young child. It's unbelievable. I mean, I feel the same way about paid sick days. When you think about this epidemic, it's a shame that people have to be forced to go to work sick. We've had testimony from workers who said, it just talks about how guilty they felt coming in, and when the employer tells them, we'll just take a lot of, you know, cold medicine or whatever, or antihistamine, and get yourself in here, you're going to lose your job. And they know that they're contagious. It's devastating to think what we're asking people to do.
Well,
we're not willing to. So let's talk about why aren't we willing to provide paid sick days either through the Healthy Families Act, which is the federal bill that's been sitting on Capitol Hill and moving nowhere, or even on a state or local level.
It's a good question. But let me put my right-wing hat on for a second, Carol, because, you know, you hear the arguments against it. One, employers just can't afford it. And two, you know, people don't use their sick days when they're sick. They play hooky and they go to the beach.
Yeah. But there's no evidence of any of that. In fact, the cities that have one paid sick days, the first one many years ago, San Francisco passed a paid sick days ordinance. And at the height of this, and people said the same thing, that they'll kill jobs, stores will close, restaurants will be in trouble. At the height of the economic crisis in 2009, what they found was that San Francisco, among any city in the country, had the strongest economic, returns than any other city. And it was like the top 10 in the world of places to do business. Now, this is a city that's had paid sick days at this point almost 7 years. And they were getting those sorts of, ratings. And so I think that it's a myth that this kills jobs. D.C. has paid sick days, although they didn't give it to they withheld it from the tip workers. They do have paid sick days. I live in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you right now the restaurants, the businesses, we have not been the least bit affected.
Why would they exclude tipped employees? I mean, you're talking about $2.13 an hour.
Well, there are opponents out there, namely the Chambers of Commerce and other business associations that have a very strong lobby. And there's no logic to excluding tip workers, because they have direct contact, right, with the workforce. But if they can lobby strong enough and hard enough and spend enough money, the National Restaurant Association and the Chambers of Commerce will have their way. I mean, we're struggling with that in campaigns straight across the country. And there's not a single thread of evidence to show that paid sick days ordinances and bills hurt business. In fact, when the state of Connecticut passed a paid sick days bill in 2011, and the governor of the state said that he was just thrown by the fact that across the state, as he traveled talking to people about paid sick days, the only people who were opposed to a paid sick days bill and law were the people who already had paid sick days. He said, I didn't meet a single person who didn't have paid sick days who didn't desperately want them.
Yeah,
because they know that it makes a difference for their family, for their livelihood, and for their community.
Yeah, I heard the same thing about, you know, the Obama health care bill. The people who were strongly against it were people who had the Cadillac health care plans.
Exactly.
So how do we get this pushed through? What should our listeners do? What are you guys working on? How do we get this pushed through?
Well, one of the things that people can do is to contact their congresspeople and ask them if they have signed on to the Healthy Families Act. Years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, it passed the Senate and didn't get through the House. And and it'll be reintroduced this year, and we want to get as many sponsors as possible. So it would be great if everyone who's listening and knows that you need paid sick days, contact their congressperson and ask them, how do you feel about the Healthy Families Act? It provides up to 7 paid sick days to people, and it's not the type of bill where there's no risk of cheating or that sort of thing. You can only use it for paid sick days. I think there's some provisions in it for part-timers that are prorated and that sort of thing. So that's the first thing on a national level. And then on local level, there are many campaigns going on in New York City. Well, just to go back to who already has paid sick days, we talked about San Francisco. We talked about D.C., the state of Connecticut, and Seattle. Washington passed a paid sick days bill, an ordinance in that city. Some cities have passed living wage ordinances that include paid sick days, but there have not been very many of those.
Right.
And currently there are campaigns happening in Portland, Oregon, in Philadelphia, where they actually, not far from you guys, you're in Pennsylvania, right?
Correct.
They actually passed the paid sick days bill in the city council in Philadelphia, but the mayor vetoed it.
Yes,
so they're trying to go back in again and get that work done. In New York City, they have a veto-proof majority in the city council, but because of the business associations, the Speaker of the House won't actually bring the vote to the floor. In Massachusetts, they've tried to pass a bill for the entire state. They're going to try to reintroduce it again this year. Orange County, Florida, and at least 10 other cities and states where they've tried to work on paid sick days. So if you have any concern about this, you can either go to the website at the Labor Project for Working Families, which is working-families.org, or you can go to Family Values at Work and look at all the cities and states that are working on these campaigns. And then your geographic area, you can begin talking to your city council member if you're in a city, or if you're involved in state politics, you can talk to your assembly people or Senate people and ask them to please about this.
And start one of your own.
The only time we worry about it is when there's an epidemic. Remember the H1N1?
Yep.
People, we've talked about it a lot then, and then once people are well, it kind of goes away, but folks are suffering with this all the time.
And here we are with H3N3, or N2, I think.
Yeah, that's the new virus, right?
Carol Joyner, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the thoughts. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick. Stay healthy.
Yeah, I'm going to try. You do the same. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
On June 30th, 1908, in a remote part of Russia, people saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky.
Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia. It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations for the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30, 1908. If it were an asteroid, it might have been about a third as big as a football field.
The object probably never struck Earth. Instead, it appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above the Siberia wilderness. For more, come to Earth.org and search for the words Tunguska or airburst. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on Earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Come and take your guns. They're going to take the guns. They're coming for the guns. Did you hear? They're coming for the guns. I chuckle when I hear that, because the right wing is all in a tizzy, and we don't even know yet. There's a lot of conjecture out there. Obama's going to take this, and he's going to do that. And there's been nothing said yet. But I guess Tuesday, Biden's going to give his ideas, and they'll come up with something. But what I find interesting is you're starting to see some of the Republicans going, well, you know, we need some rational, common sense thoughts. And I look at this guy, Phil Gingrich, who I am not really a huge fan of, Republican congressman from Georgia. He has come out and said, well, maybe we might need to start thinking about some stronger gun laws. He said there are some problems. And maybe these huge magazines, even for someone who says, look, I just use an AR-15 for target practice. But do you really need to be standing there shooting at a silhouette at a shot a second or even quicker with these kind of weapons? For what purpose, Gingrich asks. He said, I would be willing to listen to the possibility of the capacity of a magazine. I went on to say, open to the revisions of the so-called gun show loophole. Some ideas, not too happy with the right wing. He said, you're buying a used weapon from somebody and then basically there's no background check. Not thrilled with the no background check. So maybe you're going to see some movement towards universal background checks. Just a thought. And then you've got Joe Scarborough, who this morning on his program came out and said some pretty interesting things.
This is not about protecting the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. This is about gun manufacturers making millions and millions and millions of dollars. This is about retailers making millions and millions and millions of dollars. Do you know how much money these people have made over the slaughter of 20 innocents? Mm-hmm. And Newtown, do you know how much richer these rich gun manufacturers have gotten over the past month, and how the NRA uses that tragedy to gin up fears, and websites use that tragedy to gin up fears that they're coming to take your guns away? Hey, got a message for you. They can't take your guns away.
Bottom line. And, this is a former Republican congressman. Who has had a good NRA rating. And, he went on to say, and I love the going after the crazy people, but, wanted to say, look, Republicans, maybe they're going to wake up.
And if you're a survivalist and you really believe the federal government is coming to kill you and your children, if that's your view in 2013, your paranoid, sick, twisted view, well, fine. Good luck continuing to get the Republicans to jump in your pickup truck and drive off the cliff towards political oblivion, because that's what's going to happen, Republicans. Wake up.
I agree with him. It's not often I agree with Scarborough, but he's right on this. And then he goes on to, you know, say, this could have come out of my mouth.
The big lie that the NRA is pushing on gun owners to try to whip stupid people into a frenzy is they're coming to take your guns away. And I say stupid people because you have to be stupid in 2013 to believe that the federal government can come and take your handguns or come and take your shotguns. You have to be stupid.
And, you know, for all of the talk about the Heller case, you know, in D.C., the reality is Scalia did say assault weapons they can regulate. Just a thought. What I find interesting is you look at the number of this National Association of Evangelicals, evidently they did a survey of their leadership, and they found that nearly three-quarters of the evangelical leaders across the political divide, because most evangelicals, they tend to bend to the right wing, to the very conservative. Almost three-quarters are in favor of some form of gun legislation. In fact, you know, they said, you know, what the guy who's the president of the National Association of Evangelicals said, he said, look, we're pro-life and deeply grieve when any weapon is used to take innocent lives. He said the evangelical leaders who responded to the NAE survey support the Second Amendment right to bear arms, but also want our laws to prevent the slaughter of children. Also, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who have been calling for, well, for a couple decades now, for stronger gun laws, have also come out and said, you know, we need to have greater regulation. He said, with regards to the regulation of firearms first, the intent to protect one's loved one is an honorable one, but simply put, guns are too easily accessible, was their statement back in December. And someone had pulled up a statement from, you know, from them back in 1978, where they said, you know, that they believed, that only the only prohibition of importation, manufacture, sale, possession, and use of handguns, with reasonable exceptions made for police, military security guards, pistol club gun owners, be kept on, you know, private premises and secure location, would provide a comprehensive response to gun violence. So basically they're saying nobody should have except, you know, in these circumstances. So I find it really kind of interesting that, you know, the right had better, the Republicans had better wake up, because their membership, their strongest base, these evangelicals are not on their side. And I think you're going to see more people splinter off, because, and I go back to my childhood. I mean, had in my neighborhood guns been as easily available, where you could just go and go to the local Walmart and buy them? You could have gone to the local Uncle Bill's or the local Zares or the local, the local Kmart, I guess, at the time, and bought what would our neighborhood have been like? And it's what we're seeing across the country. And I stop and I go, you know, okay, well, because I went through this debate. My wife and I went through this argument ourselves. We're at not the greatest location sometimes. Do I get a gun? Because I walk out at weird hours into lonely places. Do I need one? And we had kicked it around. And then I came to my base realization. I don't want one, because I would use it. And that's troublesome. And I know. We've had this argument. You know, what if someone came after you? Well, I'm also a fatalist. So I believe in whatever's going to happen is going to happen anyway. Just how that goes. But on this gun thing, I'm increasingly moving towards regulation. When it first started, I was kind of, I want to know both sides, which I already do. But I'm increasingly moving towards that. You know what? You don't need these high power rifles. You don't need these big magazines. And I think Gingrey's right. I mean, are you going to shoot a shot in a second at a silhouette? You going to go hunting with an AK-47? No. And, you know, as I look at this, and you think about when the assault weapons ban was, you know, when it was let to expire and all of that, now we're starting to see more and more usage. Is there a cause and effect? You decide. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Montpelier, Ohio. The Montpelier Exempted Village School Board of Education has decided unanimously that they are going to arm their janitors. They've taken that whole, we want the teachers to be armed. We're going to the next level. We're going to have, it's going to be janitors next, and then crossing guards, and then the lunch lady's going to be packing heat. I can't wait. So complain that there's still stuff on the floor. Bang, you're dead. Complain that lunch sucks. It's all over. All over. And, you know, I was thinking about this. Maybe that's not a bad idea. This could be a jobs plan. We could bring the troops home from Afghanistan, hire them as janitors, and put them in the schools. Or better yet, just put them in the classrooms. We can make them all teachers. I mean, you know, you got the public school haters who think teaching isn't any tougher than assembly line factory work. Let's replace the teachers with troops with big guns. Problems solved. Well, maybe not. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and across the country. We've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, what do you think? Janitors with guns?
I saw that story, and I really did just go, huh? Huh? Really?
Yeah. You know, I go back to my high school, and we always joked that the janitor that worked at our high school was a convicted felon. So, great. That's a good guns program.
Well, I mean, everybody has a janitor who's a convicted felon, don't they?
And I asked, when I was thinking of this, we were talking about it, I was going, you know, will this come with a pay increase? Because they're generally the least paid person in the building. So now we're depending on the low-wage, minimum-wage worker in many cases to protect us?
The resentful minimum-wage worker.
And as I remember, and it's been years since I've been in school, but it's been years, I remember kids used to just torment that poor janitor, to where if that mop were a gun, it was over for everybody.
Yeah, because that's the person you want to have a gun, the person who's being bullied.
Well, I mean, you know, you look at what happened in California, perfect example.
And didn't that happen in Columbine?
Yeah, that too. I mean, but, you know, I go back to this and I think, you know, when I was a kid and you got bullied, you just went and you got in a fight with the person. We didn't have an arsenal to turn to.
Nobody had thought of it then anyway.
No, I mean, I thought of it. I just couldn't get a gun. You know, I got to be honest, in my neighborhood where I grew up, you know, guns were used quite often. People were shot quite often. Seen people shot, seen people stabbed. But you just didn't have access to it. I mean, now that everyone seems to have an arsenal and you can buy them at Walmart, why not?
It's just as though somebody turned on a faucet and said, it's okay.
Yeah, the idiots at the NRA. So, I understand Joe Biden said there's no, and I can't, this is very Biden-esque. I saw it, I go, there, you go, Joe. There's no silver bullet.
Yeah, he said, we know that there is no silver bullet, no seatbelt, so no mixed metaphors either.
There is no silver bullet. There's rational thought. There's common sense. There's, I don't know, we should have some responsibility. You know, that word responsibility keeps popping up. You know, the people who own these guns, you know, especially the ones that get stolen, maybe we should hold someone accountable. I don't know, just a thought.
It's a thought.
You know, my wife told me when she grew up, you know, where she grew up out on an avocado ranch in Southern California, her grandfather had basically a little arsenal, but it was locked. Nobody ever could get into it. Instead of just laying around. And I know people, guns laying around.
Well, in England, you can, you know, people do actually have guns in England. One of my cousins, Jacqueline, she used to shoot, you know, as a hobby. And she had a gun. And her boyfriend had a gun. Well, you had to keep them locked. And if you had pistols or anything like that, you had to keep them locked. And guess what? My memory is that the police did have a right to come in your house and check that you kept them locked.
Oh, well, that's there. That's not here.
Right. But you could have them, but you have to keep them locked. You have to keep your guns locked up. But you can have them.
Yeah. See, I'm a fan of responsibility. If your gun gets out of control, it's like your car. If your car rolls down the hill and hits somebody, somebody's responsible for it.
Actually, you know, I don't think they could come in and check. If they were there for something else, they could check, but they couldn't just come in. Now that I think about it, they couldn't come in. A man's home is his castle.
Yeah, that sounds, you know, like something the right wing would say, Victoria. They, you know, and over there, what they do...
No, a man's home is his castle.
Yeah. So what are we doing on this? You know, I saw a poll or a survey out today. 73% of evangelicals say we need to have some rational gun safety laws. The Catholics seem to be in line with it. Rational people seem to go, hey, you know, do we really need a clip with 30 rounds in it? Do we need these?
NRA members are in favor of background checks.
You know, I found it interesting, you know, Joe Scarborough this morning had some interesting comments. Actually called people stupid. I got this clip that I thought was quite humorous.
The big lie that the NRA is pushing on gun owners to try to whip stupid people into a frenzy is they're coming to take your guns away. And I say stupid people because you have to be stupid in 2013 to believe that the federal government can come and take your handguns or come and take your shotguns. You have to be stupid.
But, you know, I've talked to a lot of very stupid people. And my favorite one, I've just found out that there's a new gun cliff, according to Scarborough.
And if you're a survivalist and you really believe the federal government is coming to kill you and your children, if that's your view in 2013, your paranoid, sick, twisted view, well, fine. Good luck continuing to get the Republicans to jump in your pickup truck and drive off the cliff towards political oblivion, because that's what's going to happen, Republicans. Wake up.
The gun cliff now, Victoria.
There's so many cliffs.
So what's the word? I mean, I know the NRA was not happy yesterday. They thought that they were going to come and have... did you expect any other response from them, that they were disappointed that no one took their idea of putting a cop or now a janitor in every classroom?
No, not really. I mean, there were some people in the Washington classes were saying, you know, this is progress that they've come to the meeting. That wasn't my view. My view was that they came to the meeting because they're political operatives. And they wanted to be able to say, look, we came to the meeting, so we cooperated.
Yep.
They never had any intention of moving at all on gun laws unless it was towards making them more lax.
I mean, I just don't buy the whole, you know, we need to have more guns. I've never bought that. You know, I think it's because I grew up in a housing project where guns were probably used the wrong way. And you had high density, you had a large number of people in a small area. Or I just don't know, a whole bunch of people being angry at each other, shooting each other. You know, I've always had this idea that, you know, if two people want to shoot each other, that's okay. But I have the kind of luck that they would both miss and hit me. And I guess that's my fear of more people with guns.
Well, I think it's a concern. More guns means more opportunities.
Although, there, you know, and I've always thought also, you know, it's a way we thin the herd. You know, the guy who, you know, who looks down the hole and pulls the trigger doesn't, you know, reproduce. But that seems to not be the case as often, because we're saving those people, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah. So did you like my idea of bringing the troops home and putting them in the classroom? Because maybe we're going to bring them back from Afghanistan. They're going to have to go to work somewhere. Why not teachers?
Well, we're going to have to put them to work. There's no question about that. And today, at the joint press conference, President Obama and President Karzai of Afghanistan announced a slight acceleration of the timeline for the U.S. to hand control of security to Afghan forces. The transition is going to happen in the spring rather than in the summer. So there is a slight speeding up. That doesn't mean that they're all going to start withdrawing quicker. But the president is going to outline his plans for the continued drawdown of troop levels in the coming months. But, you know, the White House floated the option of zero troops earlier this week after 2014.
Now, I got to be honest, I've been in favor of that for quite some time.
And, you know, I think more and more Americans are.
Yeah. What's going on with the debt ceiling?
Well, it's interesting because, in a way, nothing is going on with the debt ceiling because Congress is out, so nothing can be happening. But some Democratic leadership wrote to the president today a letter that Politico got hold of, which is kind of interesting in itself, that
it,
you know, people get hold of these letters, in which Harry Reid and other leaders said in a very strongly worded letter that Obama must make clear that you will never allow our nation's economy and reputation to be held hostage, and basically said that failing to raise the debt ceiling will threaten the full faith and credit of the U.S., and said that in the event that Republicans make good on their threat by failing to act or by moving unilaterally to pass a debt limit extension only as part of an unbalanced or unreasonable legislation, we believe you must be willing to take any lawful steps.
The coin!
To ensure that America does not break its promises and trigger a global economic crisis without congressional approval if necessary.
Yeah, bring on the coin!
Or could it be the 14th Amendment?
See, that's where I would go. The coin seems a little far-fetched to me. At first when I heard it, I thought it was a joke, but there are actually people who are actually thinking this is a very serious, a good idea. I don't.
Yeah, none of them are on Wall Street, by the way.
Oh, yeah, but I still don't think the coin is a good idea. The symbol of the coin, not a good idea. Now, I do think if you did go the coin route, I think, you know, like a Mount Rushmore type look of, you know, Hoover, Reagan, and George W. Bush would be a perfect trio for that coin.
Right.
But I don't think you go the coin route. I'm more in favor of, look, we're paying our bills. One way or another, we're paying our bills.
I think that that's the route that if they're going to go, they're going to go. But the White House has ruled out the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, and you go, why would you take that off, though? In any negotiations, you never take something off the table completely. You say, well, I don't want to use it, but you back me into a corner, I may be left with no option. Even as dumb of the idea as the coin, I think the coin is, still leave it on the table. Hey, I'll make a coin, a big one, too. Might even create a couple of jobs.
They haven't taken the coin off the table completely. I mean, Carney seemed to, and then he referred questions to the Treasury Department, so he didn't take it off the table completely. But they have taken the 14th Amendment off the table, which is more surprising.
But to me, it shows just how far the Republicans are willing to go. And it'll be interesting to see how far they push this. And the thing that has caught my eye, I look at what's going on with, the money for the cleanup of Hurricane Sandy and how long this has taken and the drawn-out process. And I see Representative Braun today from Georgia, a bunch of amendments stripping money out of it, you know, money for studying flood research, money for studying oil spill research, money to help fund our weather satellites. Just stuff that you go, well, it makes sense that we should be thinking about, you know, how do we improve the levees around New York? How do we do some of that? Maybe put some money into it. They want to pull that out of there.
Because there's no thought about how to stop anything in the future.
Is that what it is?
It is quite astonishing to me that there isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of it is, you know, sustaining the weather research programs, coming up with new models to improve weather forecasting. Nothing for the future. It's all tip of the nose stuff. And I guess this is what worries me about these kind of folks who are running our government into the ground.
Well, there's a distinct possibility that this Sandy bill may get bogged down and not passed.
You know, and people wonder, you know, people wonder why cockroaches have almost a better approval rating than Congress does.
Yes. I mean, if you actually want to see Chris Christie explode like Mr. Creosote in the Monty Python sketch, that could happen.
Then it might be worth it to me then. And I think
yes.
It might be worth it to the residents of New Jersey.
Yes.
That would be one way to get rid of him. And maybe our governor, Tom Corbett, would be standing next to him because today our governor went and privatized our lottery system. Yay! So a company from, I guess it's a company from Great Britain will be running the Pennsylvania lottery. How nice.
That's nice for you.
Beautiful. Victoria, always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in a Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? Ask Me members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Earth, sky. On June 30th, 1908, in a remote part of Russia, people saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky.
Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia.
It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations for the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30, 1908. If it were an asteroid, it might have been about a third as big as a football field.
The object probably never struck Earth. Instead, it appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above the Siberia wilderness. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Tunguska or airburst. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org. Earth, Sky.
On June 30th, 1908, in a...
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Just blows my mind. I mean, you look at this thing with Gingrey, and I guess it really shouldn't. I mean, these are the believers. These are the people who, they believe. Yeah, we don't need to invest in any of that technology stuff. We don't need to invest in thinking about what tomorrow is going to look like. We don't need to do any of that stuff. We don't need satellites. We don't need prevention. We don't need to study futures, what storms are going to look like. We don't need any of that. Ah, come on. No, we don't need that. And what bothers me is you're talking about a very small amount of resource that could save. And I guess, we used to understand this back in the old days, back when, ounce of prevention, pound of cure. Does that anybody remember that? Apple a day, doctor away, prevention. That's what those messages were. Take preventative measures. Maybe, and I remember right after Katrina had happened. They said, there was a report back in the 90s that predicted all of this and said this is what we need to do to make sure that this doesn't happen. Because we fund studies like this to say, okay, what are the worst case scenarios? How do we avoid them? How do we prevent these catastrophes? And I look at this very short-sighted. You're pulling out of what in the size of this bill is very small amounts of money. But could have huge consequences. Kind of like, you heard all of the screaming about Benghazi. And I go back to, it was the Republicans who pulled the money out of the budget for it. And, you go, when you don't have the resource, when the money's not there, where do you get it? Do you pull it out of thin air? And look, the coin thing keeps coming up, and while I thought it was a joke to start, if I'm president and I'm faced with a Congress like the one we have, who is willing to take us to the depths, who's willing to pursue scorched earth, do I think about the coin? Do I think about minting? And there's part of me that says, let's mint a couple of really big ones. Make them really big and really ceremonial and make them, so that, you see how ridiculous this is because we've got a party in this country who refuses to pay their bills unless they can extract an ounce of a pound of flesh. And that's really what this is all about. This is their ideology. Remember, this is the belief people. These people come from that culture of I believe. I can't prove it, but I believe it. I believe privatization works. Even though no one's been able to show me a scenario where privatization has actually benefited you and me. And maybe in their world, privatization works for the handfuls. Just like the other belief, I believe tax cuts for billionaires creates jobs. Yet we don't see that. I believe vouchers work. Yeah, I believe charter schools are better. Cyber charters are better. They're not. You know, like I said the other day, I happened to be watching Chris Christie give his State of New Jersey speech. The State of New Jersey. Like Corbett's going to give the State of the Commonwealth here in the coming days. Where he just ticked off right-wing wet dream after right-wing wet dream. And I look at this again. Be angry. Be frustrated. Call your representative and say, look, privatizing the lottery makes no sense. Especially since we got really nothing for it. I mean, that's what blows my mind. We're at the end of the day going to be holding the bag. But again, but it comes back to that, I believe. It's the ideology. And all of the facts in the world, all of the reality, not going to help. Because this is that visceral thing. And I can't, someone emailed me this kind of funny quote. And I guess it's not funny. It's more sad than funny. But this self-proclaimed prophet, her name's Cindy Jacobs. She seems to believe that everything comes from above. And look, I mean, you can believe that. But she said, we believe we're moving into a supernatural season where, if needed, God will multiply food. She said, I've seen God multiply food on more than one occasion. You know, one time I was cooking and I remember spooning out spaghetti or whatever it was. Just praying in the spirit that over that, and God made it more and more and more. And you know, I've seen oil multiply as I was praying for the sick. I've seen bottles of oil just fill up a cup at a time of oil. But the point is, we were promised supernatural provisions. And she goes on, and as if the spaghetti analogy or whatever it was wasn't enough. Couldn't even remember what it was. She just remembered it was more. And if the oil wasn't enough, if that wasn't far out, if that wasn't enough for you sitting in the audience going, wow, loony. If that wasn't enough to get you up and leave, when she starts saying, you remember when we used to drive our cars? One set of tires? How many miles was it? And then they went to a commercial break, came back, and you know, way, way beyond we could ever happen on one set of tires. And you go, wait a second. And then she said, I mean, remember one time I had a pair of shoes? First it went to tires, then it was shoes. And I wore and wore and wore and wore it. And for years, wore those shoes, and they just didn't wear out. And I wore them for years and years and years, she said. Just didn't wear out. So, you know, her final line is, you know, sometimes God is saying little epiphanies to us, little things to us. But we don't know how to listen, like shoes lasting a couple of years, like tires lasting longer than they used to. Not that Dow Chemical had anything to do with that, not that the Michelin man did anything. No, no, that's from above. Wow. And I guess one could make the argument that God created the person who worked for Dow Chemical. And that, if she had she gone into that, I may have not thought she was a lunatic. Problem is we keep listening to too many lunatics. Maybe we should stop. And maybe move back from the I believe brink. And say, you know what, when you want to hock off our lottery, prove what it is you're doing. Show me it's a good deal. Show me a track record. The track record that I see, increased costs. The track record that I see, companies not honoring their obligations. The track records that I see, you, me, the taxpayer, holding the bag. So I say before that meeting, you get to your representative. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to download the podcast. Stitcher. We'll see you.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next
But there was something about the playing of the kind of music we did, the people I worked with, that was just emotionally moving to a lot of people. And these college bars were strange places. You probably hung out in them. You know what I'm saying.
No, I know exactly, and I know the smell and everything. Hey, Bill, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here because we're on top of the end of the program. Well, hopefully we'll hear from
you. I appreciate the help so much. You